Of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have four bills, all of them dealing with prescription drugs and or medical devices on the agenda. We've heard either last session, we heard two of the bills, and the other two we heard during a December hearing. So we are going to try and be very brief with the testimony. For most part, we're going to have try and limit testimony on each side to 5 or 7 minutes, and members of the committee may have lots of questions, so it may extend beyond that. The first bill, because we added, because medical device manufacturers did not testify in December, they were able to, but we want to be sensitive to that, so we're giving maybe 10, 12 minutes for their opposition. Or their concerns on the first bill. But otherwise, we want to be as quick as we can since we have had hearings on the bills, but to have the authors present the bills in maybe 5 to 7 minutes on each side for each one, and then committee discussion. But we're going to begin by inviting Senior Federation to talk about prescription drug issues for a very brief period, 3, 4, 5 minutes. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourselves as you begin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Bob Hines, and I reside in Senate District 63. I'm here representing the Minnesota Senior Federation. Larry Kennebec from Senate District 45 is accompanying me today, and in the interest of brevity for today's proceedings, I will be speaking on behalf of my fellow Senior Federation members. The Minnesota Senior Federation is a grassroots statewide organization with an active membership and a strong voice advocating for senior issues. A long-standing issue for our members has been the cost of prescription drugs. Now, throughout our history, the Senior Federation has been actively involved in working towards providing relief for our membership through programs aimed at lowering prescription drug costs. At one time in the 1980s, we initiated the nation's first bus trips to Canada. That was in the 90s, and in the 80s, we owned and operated a pharmacy. And the bus trips to Canada that we initiated was designed to buy lower-cost prescription drugs for our members. We continued those bus trips into the mid-2000s. We led national efforts to implement a drug importation program, which was later replicated by Minnesota and other states, and which continues to this day. These efforts were initiated to give seniors immediate relief from the cost of prescription drugs. Concurrently, throughout this time, we worked to influence public policy and increase the attention created around prescription drug costs in the public sphere. The four pieces of legislation that you are considering today will directly affect the cost of prescription drugs. Through our many efforts over the years, it has become apparent to us that one of the more troubling aspects of the prescription drug industry is the undue influence that pharmaceutical companies have over the patient-doctor relationship. The most expensive device in medicine, goes the often cited maxim, is the doctor's pen. It is estimated that 70 to 80% of healthcare costs originate with a doctor's orders. In particular, the common practice of providing gifts and other perks to prescribing doctors is rather telling. The drug representative or detailer's influence has grown out of the doctor's office. According to the National Survey of Physicians conducted by the Kaiser Family Foundation, most doctors say they have received perks from a drug representative, with a majority reporting they have received meals, tickets to events, or free travel. Furthermore, numerous articles cite research that shows doctors overestimate their immunity to the largesse of the drug industry. A New York Times article illustrates this point. In one study of medical residents, 61% of respondents said they were unaffected by industry marketing. However, when asked their opinion about other doctors, just 16% of the residents believed that their colleagues exhibited the same resistance. In all, the pharmaceutical industry spent nearly $30 billion on promotion and marketing of prescription drugs in 2005, with $7.2 billion directed toward physicians. This means drug companies are spending $8,800 in direct marketing to each doctor practicing in America. In the end, this marketing has led to physicians prescribing more and more expensive and often unnecessary medications, driving up costs of prescriptions to the public. Importantly, the savings posed by implementing prohibitions on such gifts will be realized by consumers and insurers alike, according to Sidney Wolf, director of the Health Research for Public Citizen, a nonprofit consumer advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. The amount of money that a health system will lose from not accepting gifts and sponsoring of educational conferences, Mr. Wolf states, is nickels and dimes compared to the savings patients will experience when they aren't prescribed the most expensive drugs inappropriately. The Minnesota Senior Federation has long been active in pursuing fair prescription drug policies for seniors, and in doing so, the Federation has become all too aware of the problems surrounding pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs, and their practices. PBMs are often referred to as the middlemen between the drug companies and health plans, insurance companies, and government programs. In many cases, they provide useful services for managing prescription drug benefits for these organizations. However, PBMs and their activities are not always so helpful, especially when considering whose interests many PBMs ultimately serve, the drug companies. In many lawsuits brought against PBMs by numerous and varied state and local governments, private corporations, pharmacists, HMOs, unions, and individuals, PBMs and their activities have been shown to be shrouded in secrecy and replete with questionable practices. In spite of recent litigation and industry promises to improve transparency, these practices do not seem to be diminishing. Enacting PBM transparency legislation will help to remove the shroud of secrecy surrounding PBMs, ensuring those contracting with them actually have enough information to evaluate and compare PBM proposals and practices, thus making the marketplace more competitive. We at the Minnesota Senior Federation strongly support the Minnesota Legislature's efforts to rein in the loosely monitored activities of PBMs and the pharmaceutical companies whose best interests they ultimately support. We encourage you to join the growing consensus among state governments that contracts between PBMs and their clients should be made more transparent and clarified, that inherent conflicts of interest should be eliminated, and that ethical standards which apply to similar professions should be implemented. We at the Minnesota Senior Federation have seen the way the drug companies have been able to manipulate and influence the prescribing habits and tendencies of physicians, either through gifts and incentives or through sponsorship of educational conferences. As I mentioned earlier, the pharmaceutical industry employs a sales force of over 90,000 drug representatives and spends an average of $8,800 directly marketing their products to physicians. This type of detailing has been increasing for nurse practitioners and physician assistants as well, accounting for 21.7% of total detail activity in 2006. And although research shows that physicians understand the conflict of interest that exists between marketing and patient care, contact with pharmaceutical sales representatives remains one of the main ways that doctors learn about the medications they prescribe. In recent years, the drug industry's influence on the medical profession and prescribing has become more widely recognized because, one, prescription drug costs continue to escalate and are one of the fastest growing segments of the nation's health care spending, and two, serious drug safety issues and controversies discovered after new drugs have been introduced and heavily promoted by the drug companies have become more common. A good example of the latter is the case of Vioxx, which was withdrawn from the market due to increased risk of heart attacks associated with its use. It was estimated that in the year prior to its withdrawal, $208 million was spent on physician detailing and $256 million on direct-to-consumer advertising for this class of drugs, driving utilization far beyond what was necessary based on patient needs. An important part of the proposed legislation is the implementation of evidence-based academic detailing programs, which rely on unbiased scientific perspectives rather than marketing hype. These types of programs are an important tool to counter the sales-focused information provided through drug company representatives. Most importantly, academic detailing has been shown repeatedly to be effective in promoting safe and appropriate drug use. As I think of the many seniors and other Minnesotans who struggle in these difficult economic times to make ends meet, who often face choices between paying for medicine and paying for food, it is clear to me that additional layers of consumer protection are needed to prevent the drug companies from taking advantage of their economic might. Academic detailing is one proven and effective way to guard against the marketing of expensive and unnecessary name brand drugs when less costly and reliable generic drug options can fill those same needs. I urge you to join our fellow states that are using academic detailing as a way to reduce prescription drug costs, improve the quality of care, and increase the value derived from drug coverage programs. In Minnesota, as in other states, the protection of an individual's right to medical privacy is considered fundamental. When you or I go to a pharmacy to fill a prescription, we are instructed to stand behind a line while we wait to speak with a pharmacist. This is meant to protect the privacy of our medical information from prying eyes and to protect the confidentiality of the provider-patient relationship. There is, however, nothing that you or I, the consumer, can do about maintaining the same protection over our prescription information once we leave the pharmacy. This is because of the insidious and prevalent practice of data mining, which is used by the pharmaceutical companies to target the marketing and promotion of their products to our prescribing physicians. Data mining involves the sale of doctors prescribing information by pharmacies to intermediary companies, the so-called health information organizations. The prescribing information is then bundled into aggregated pharmacy data that can be repackaged and resold to pharmaceutical companies. That data, when coupled with individual physician identities bought from the American Medical Association, gives the drug companies and their representatives important resources to tailor marketing strategies, messages, gifts, and other inducements back to our physicians. Because of this, many consumers may be offered higher-priced or, in some cases, less effective medications than may otherwise be indicated. Particularly troubling is the conflict of interest that the AMA knowingly and willfully benefits from, receiving over $40 million yearly from the sale of physician profiles to data mining companies. This practice of data mining and selling of prescriber data takes place without the knowledge or consent of many physicians and undermines the very notion of privacy of medical information that is so important to the public trust between doctor and patient. We strongly urge you to pass this important legislation that protects our consumers from these underhanded and reprehensible practices. These problems of undue influence of the pharmaceutical industry over medical professionals greatly undermines the public trust and the autonomy of physicians to make unbiased and informed decisions. As a concerned citizen and as a constituent representative of Minnesota's senior population, I am extremely concerned about the unfair, unethical, and medically questionable practices of the drug companies. The undue influence these companies exert on the prescribing habits of doctors affects senior citizens particularly, as seniors are prescribed and consume a larger share of medications in the state. It is therefore imperative that we pass stricter guidelines for the protection of the patient-provider relationship and for remedying the undue influence that pharmaceutical companies have been able to achieve over doctors, and in turn, to help Minnesotans find relief from spiraling prescription drug costs. On behalf of the seniors across the state and the Minnesota Senior Federation, I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman.
We're going to start with Senator Pretner Solon's bill in just a minute because I'm waiting for an amendment on mine. Senator Corey.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, thanks for the testimony, but I'm troubled when we almost make it sound like the drug manufacturers are the big bad evil people, and I guess I kind of got that out of that testimony, but I'm going to wait until some of these bills come up because I'm really troubled with a lot of these bills that are coming forward, and I certainly have some questions when these bills come up, but I would point out the fact that I think that we have a lot of great drug companies in this country that are doing a great job, and so I reject the fact that they're the bad guys and we're always after them.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hand.
Can I just make a comment? I'd like to echo my colleague Senator Coring's comments here. I think the testimony was, I thought it was very extreme. He made lots of charges about behaviors of drug companies without offering any evidence at all that any of these things that he's alleging have occurred. And I think to have someone come in and make a blanket statement that the pharmaceutical industry is acting in a reprehensible way and taking advantage of people and doing unethical things and not bringing any information that would substantiate that claim at all, I really question the value of that testimony. And we'll wait and see what we hear on the bills in particular, but I'm really troubled by that.
Thank you, Senator Hand. Senator Pretner Solon, I'm going to join you up there because we've been working on these bills. And go ahead and present Senate File 1238.
So, Mr. Chair, I am going to try to be non-judgmental and factual. And I want to thank the committee for giving me the opportunity to present Senate File 1238. And first of all, though, I have an amendment to put the bill in the shape I'd like it. This would be an author's amendment.
Thank you.
I think
do
you
we
have it in front of you. It is the A1 amendment.
Members, do you have a copy of it? Is it delete all?
Yep. So I would move the A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move the amendment, Senator?
Yes.
Okay, all of those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
No.
The amendment is adopted.
Thank you. And Madam Chair and committee members, you've probably all heard this bill before. I've introduced it and had hearings and actually passed it in the Senate. It has been lost in omnibus bills before when the governor vetoed it, the omnibus bill. Or sometimes we've not been able to have a companion pass. So it may be familiar to many of you. And the other bill is one,
Senator,
that this committee has heard before, too.
Sorry, but you need to put the microphone closer to you because we cannot hear you.
You can't hear me?
Can you pull it closer? A little bit hard to hear.
I can hear myself really clearly.
Project.
You can't hear me?
You just pull it a little closer.
We can hear you now.
You can. Okay. Okay. So I'll begin. We all recognize that the skyrocketing cost of prescription drugs is one of the most pressing issues of our time. One of the victims of these rising costs is our state Medicaid program, which provides a prescription drug benefit to Medicaid recipients. According to statistics compiled by our state Medicaid program, fee-for-service pharmacy expenditures peaked at $427 million in 2005, which is a 190% increase from the $147 million that was spent in 1996. Prescription drug costs represent approximately 10% of all Medicaid expenditures in the United States. They continue to be one of the fastest-growing categories of Medicaid expenditures, rising by double digits throughout the decade. Part of the reason for the drastic increases in prescription drug costs under our Medicaid program is inflated prices reported by the manufacturers. Price reporting legislation passed in Texas was the first of its kind in the nation, and it was legislation that that they took from us, that we introduced, and then they passed in their legislature. It would be an important tool in our state's strategy to keeping access to affordable health care. Maine was impressed with our efforts to pass legislation in Minnesota and has since passed its own reporting laws. It is considered a model for other states seeking to keep Medicaid and other pharmaceutical costs under control and to prevent fraud. Passing this legislation would put Minnesota in good company. 13 other states and the District of Columbia have passed similar legislation. Senate File 1238 is the first step in making prices more transparent and understandable to purchasers. Senate File 1238 requires that pharmacy benefit managers and drug manufacturers, and pharmacy benefit managers are PBMs, and drug manufacturers comply with current Minnesota statute. And I have a copy of that statute in front of you. It's statute 151.061. This was passed in 1973 and has never been enforced. In effect, this bill would prevent PBMs and manufacturers from discrimination between purchasers of prescriptions by selling prescription drugs at a lower price or rate than offered to another purchaser after making allowances for certain legitimate cost differences, if they exist. The bill also prevents PBMs from self-dealing by embracing schemes of special rebates, such as access rebates, administration rebates, market share rebates, and collateral contracts with prescription drug manufacturers or similar devices that are to the benefit of the PBM. All of these are schemes that at times may cause an individual to pay many times the actual cost of the drug and just the copay, and then the rebate comes back to the contract holder with the PBM. In short, many times, I mean, 1,000 times over, the copay may be 1,000 times over the cost of the actual drug cost. In short, Senate File 1238 further strengthens the enforcement provision of Minnesota Statute 151.061, Subdivision 1, by specifically giving the Attorney General the authority and responsibility to enforce the remedy present in Subdivision 2. This bill aims to remove the layer of fog and secrecy that surrounds the complexity of the deals cut by PBMs and manufacturers, which ultimately results in the public's ability to know whether they are getting a good deal and what the drugs they are purchasing actually cost. This legislation requires standards for disclosure, transparency, and enforcement that are legal and necessary and would help end unfair price discrimination and thus save money for taxpayers, employers, and consumers in Minnesota. In the middle of the decade, Minnesota was able to recover more than $3 million in situations where the drug companies were caught reporting fraudulent AWPs, average wholesale prices, that caused our Medicaid program to pay excessive reimbursements, or where reporting fraudulent best prices, or AMPs, average manufacturer's prices, caused the state to lose Medicaid rebate payments. This bill could achieve significant savings for the state. If this bill caused the state to save just 1% of our Medicaid and state health plan drug costs each year and resulted in a mere 1% increase to the Medicaid rebate payments we receive each year. The state could save over $7 million every year. That's just 1%. Minnesota does not require drug companies to report pricing information directly to the state's Medicaid program. We receive pricing information used for reimbursement of health care providers from various private drug pricing reporting services, among them PBMs, the pharmaceutical benefit managers, which are the intermediaries to whom drug companies report their pricing information. By making this information more transparent, the state and other healthcare consumers could know what their medications cost and whether PBMs really are achieving the kinds of savings they claim. There have been some reports that PBMs only pass along half the savings they have achieved. It is also clear that there is a conflict of interest when drug companies own the same PBMs with which they negotiate prescription prices, which is the case in many instances. Because there is no transparency of prices, it is impossible for employer groups to know if they are being overcharged. Small pharmacies are being underpaid, and all of us are paying higher out-of-pocket costs. Why is it that the same medications in Canada and other countries cost 40 to 50% less than they do in the United States? You may hear from PBM representatives and drug manufacturers that having to share pricing information will reduce competition and cause a rise in prescription prices. This seems very unlikely and without any evidence base that I have seen. And Madam Chair, Senator Marty is sitting with me at the table today because we have collaborated on some of these bills, and he has carried half of this bill in the past. And so we're both here to respond to questions. Today I've asked that Carla Heil from the Attorney General's office provide some comments on the legal aspects of this bill. And I've also asked Cody Weiberg to provide some overview on prescription drug pricing.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carla Heil. As Senator Pretner Solon said, although the Minnesota Unfair Drug Pricing Bill 151.061 has been on the books for years, we are not aware of any case involving that. And there is no enforcement provision by the Attorney General's office in the present state law. So we do support having the Attorney General have the ability to enforce the present 151.061 and also support including PBMs under the unfair and discriminatory drug pricing. Although the Attorney General's office has brought other lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies in the past, and as Senator Pretner Solon has said, we have collected millions of dollars on behalf of the state with the average wholesale price, this would give the state of Minnesota another way to recoup costs and to limit unfair pricing.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Thank you. Senator Prentice-Owen, would you like to call your next testifier?
Yes, the next testifier is Cody Weiberg, who is the director of the Minnesota Pharmacies Association.
Senator Hand.
Before we, could I ask one question of the witness that's currently here?
Please.
Before she leaves, I just wanted to know, you said that there were, since 1973 when the law was passed, there have been no cases brought under this law, although it does provide for civil action damages. So does that mean there have been no violations of the law? If there's been no actions brought in any court under this law?
Ms. Heil.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I am aware of no recorded case. That's what I have looked at, have done legal research, that it has not. There may have been an individual who has brought it, but I am not aware of that. Instead, it hasn't reached any appellate level or some other court where we're aware of it. And simply because even if a lawsuit is not brought, it does not mean that there isn't any violation. It just simply means it hasn't been brought because this is a complicated area.
Okay. And,
Madam Chair, I misrepresented Dr. Cody Weiberg. He's a executive director or director of the Minnesota Pharmacy Board.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
On Senator Hand's comment, the question, 151061, as Ms. Heil mentioned, is not that we know been enforced anywhere, but anybody selling drugs other than at retail to different prices to different consumers in Minnesota, other than you can account for volume, other than you can account for distance shipped and so on, but otherwise identical drugs are supposed to be sold. The seller determines what the price is, but you cannot discriminate against certain purchasers. And I would argue that that's broken routinely, and that a lot of the people who are going to testify saying, well, these are trade secrets what our prices are, because if one customer knows how much everybody else is paying, they're going to want the same price. Well, if you're not charging them the same price, you're violating the law.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
And Senator Marty. That part was part of my question. My understanding is that the PBMs are doing business with organizations. I would think that those are large organizations with lots of resources and access to attorneys, and if they felt that there was some discrimination being exercised against them in terms of pricing, it seems to me they would have a recourse here. And if it has never been used, that would tell me that they don't feel there's been any violation of this law. And I guess one other question is, do we have laws like this that refer to pricing on other products and goods, or is it just with the pharmaceutical or prescription drugs that we have this law? Is this law general to all products, goods, and services sold in Minnesota, or just prescription drugs?
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, this applies only, this is Chapter 151. The only thing, as you can see at the beginning, any person doing business in the state engaged in distribution other than retail of any prescription drugs who shall discriminate between purchasers. It's specific to prescription drugs.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I would suggest one reason this law has never been enforced is that it's unenforceable. That's probably why it hasn't been, but I don't know. I'm not an attorney, so we'll let somebody else answer.
Madam Chair,
Senator Marty.
That's the point of the rest of the bill. If the prices are able to be to find out what people are charging, then you can know whether they're discriminating, and then you can enforce the law.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. However, I should clarify that I think the reason I may have been asked to talk today is twofold. There are some implications for the Board of Pharmacy and the various legislation before you today. But in addition, before coming to the Board of Pharmacy in September of 2005, I was the pharmacy program manager for the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I held that position for 6 years. So I think what Senator Pretner-Solon would like me to talk about today is to just give a little bit of background, and so I'm really speaking on background and not necessarily on behalf of the Board of Pharmacy at this point. And I think what the Senator would like me to talk about a little bit is the structure, which can be somewhat confusing, to say the least. The pharmaceutical industry, the pricing in the pharmaceutical industry is very complex. The players involved are very complex. And so I think there are some things that that might be useful to the committee in considering these bills. First of all, there's how drugs are distributed. And drugs obviously are produced by manufacturers. They are typically sold by the manufacturers to wholesale distributors. There are three or four major wholesale distributors in the country and many, many what are called secondary and tertiary wholesale distributors. The distributors then generally sell to pharmacies, to clinics, hospitals, etc. I think some of the pricing differential that you see occurs because it is to the benefit of pharmaceutical manufacturers to give preferential pricing to entities that can influence market share. So, for example, you would find that hospitals typically pay less for drugs than retail pharmacies. You'd find that mail-order pharmacies which many of which are owned by pharmacy benefit managers, pay less for drugs than retail community pharmacies. This is because in the case of hospital pharmacies, particularly large teaching hospitals, if a manufacturer can get a drug on formulary and get the young doctors who are training using that drug, they're going to be more likely to use that drug in the future. In the case of mail-order pharmacies that are owned by PBMs, the PBMs themselves make decisions about what drugs they will cover, what drugs they will include on their formularies. And formularies are lists of drugs that are covered by the PBM. And often those formularies are set up so that there are differential copays, tiered copays. So if you get generic drugs, you may have to pay the smallest copay. If you get a preferred brand name drug, you would pay the next level copay. And if you want a non-preferred brand name drug, you would pay the highest level copay. And the difference between the preferred and non-preferred brand name drugs often comes down, hopefully it comes down first, and we did this at DHS, is we try to consider the clinical considerations first. One of our mottos there, if you will, is that we would rather pay for the more expensive drug if it's truly a better drug. So hopefully that's done first. But if all other things are equal, if all the drugs in the class are judged to be the same in terms of efficacy and side effects, then the PBM is probably going to have preferred drugs for which they get the lowest net cost, which generally means a combination of just lower base pricing and higher rebates. A PBM, other than those that own mail-order pharmacies, they typically otherwise do not distribute medications themselves. They are hired by insurers or large employers to manage the pharmacy benefit. One of the things that they do is they contract with chains of pharmacy, or actually a network of pharmacies, chain pharmacies and independent pharmacies, and hopefully they do that in a way so they get broad coverage across the state of pharmacies that are included. They negotiate reimbursement rates with the pharmacies. They do that. The standard over the years has been using something called AWP, or average wholesale price. The joke about average wholesale price in the industry is AWP also stands for ain't what's paid. There is no discernible connection, definitive discernible connection between the published average wholesale price and what any particular pharmacy or clinic might pay for it, because there is a differential pricing. That is why just about all payers, including the Medicaid program in this state, know that pharmacies and physicians and clinics are paying less than average wholesale price. And when they determine the reimbursement formulas, they work into a discount into the formula. Currently in Minnesota Medicaid fee-for-service, the discount is 14% less, 14% below AWP. So the assumption is that on average, retail pharmacies are purchasing the drugs for 14% less than the published average wholesale price. And then the dispensing fee of $3.65 is added back in. It is, of course, physicians and advanced nurse practitioners, dentists, optometrists, podiatrists, they can prescribe drugs, and pharmacies typically dispense them. And again, other than their mail order pharmacies, PBMs do not directly dispense drugs. In terms of Medicaid or any other payer, really, Medicaid does not directly pay manufacturers for drugs. Medicaid pays pharmacies to dispense drugs, and it pays physicians and clinics to administer drugs. The net cost to Medicaid is determined by taking the payments that are made out to those providers and subtracting the rebates that are collected from manufacturers. Medicaid rebates in the fee-for-service program are determined by federal law Section 1927 of the Social Security Act. The information is considered under federal law to be non-disclosable. It's proprietary. And in fact, state Medicaid agencies every quarter get what's called a unit rebate amount and are not privy to the actual negotiations that CMS has with the manufacturers in terms of Medicaid rebates. But the net cost for Medicaid, and it's the same is true for most private payers, is going to be the amount paid out to the pharmacy, for example, minus the rebates that are collected on the backside. So I think that gives sort of a summary of how the structure works. That is a 25,000-foot level.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver. That was an excellent overview. I have to remind you, Senator, that we said at the beginning we're going to limit the testimony to 5 minutes because we've heard this before, and so I'm hoping that we can stick to that because you have two people that wish to testify in opposition, so we're running out of time. Any questions for the witness? Thank you for your testimony. I believe there are two individuals who wish to testify. If they could please come to the table. Mr. Rowan and Mr. Cypra, please. Welcome to the committee, and if you could please introduce yourselves.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Vernon Rowan. I'm the Vice President of Government Affairs for Express Scripts. We're a pharmacy benefit manager. We have a large office here in Bloomington, Minnesota, about 1,500 employees. I'd like to take a minute to talk about what a PBM is and what a PBM does, because Mr. Weiberg from the Board of Pharmacy actually did a pretty good job of describing the marketplace, the dynamics, and pricing. But I want to make real clear, there was a comment made that many PBMs are owned by drug manufacturers. No PBMs are owned by drug manufacturers currently. My PBM is an independent PBM that has always been an independent PBM. There are some PBMs that are owned by chain drugstores. Some PBMs are owned by health plans that use the PBM services, but no PBMs are owned by drug manufacturers. PBMs are entities that came into existence about 20 years ago. They evolved in the marketplace as the use of prescription drugs became more prevalent, more drugs came on the market, drugs were prescribed for more conditions, and health plans, employers, governments who were paying for prescription drugs realized they needed someone to help them organize the prescription drug benefit. Organize it in a number of terms. Pay claims for them, but also make sure they were getting the best price possible for the drugs that they were purchasing on behalf of their patients. As time has gone by, our role has evolved as the marketplace has demanded those things. And today, we provide a very comprehensive set of services to the clients who voluntarily choose to use our services. We negotiate drug prices with manufacturers. We negotiate with chain store retail pharmacies to make sure we're getting the best price there. We also use a vast array of clinical tools and electronic systems that help ensure safety in the use of these drugs. There was some discussion of formularies and how formularies work. There was a suggestion that PBMs decide what's on a drug formulary. Let me talk about the relationship with the people who hire us. The people who hire us ultimately make the decision on the formulary they want to use, the tools they want to use to manage that formulary. They also make a decision on how they want to work with us, how they want to pay us for our services, how aggressively they want us to negotiate rebates with drug manufacturers, how aggressively they want us to promote generic drugs, which is an important part of our business. We make recommendations to them, but they ultimately make the decision on how they want their drug benefit managed. They also make decisions in terms of whether they want all the rebates that we negotiate with drug manufacturers, or whether instead of paying us an admin fee, they would rather choose to share those rebates with us. it's a very robust example of the marketplace working. In fact, really the only alternative to this system that we have right now would be, and perhaps that is what some people might be interested in doing, is setting prices for drugs in this country. And I'll actually argue that, at least with respect to the PBM provisions of this bill, and there are a couple here, that you will end up setting drug prices. This bill doesn't set drug prices, but this bill eliminates the ability of the private marketplace to drive discounts from drug manufacturers. Now, there may be an assumption that if everyone pays the same price for the drugs that are made available, that everyone will get the best price. Evidence is to the contrary. In fact, there is a suggestion that there is no evidence to that claim. There's actually quite a bit of evidence, and I'd like to share with the committee five letters from the Federal Trade Commission that have been written to five different states that have considered legislation like this that would require the disclosures that are required of PBMs in terms of their manufacturer contracts. And the FTC has consistently said that this type of disclosure will have an anti-competitive effect. It will not lower drug prices, and in fact, it will actually encourage tacit collusion between drug manufacturers and their setting of prices. Look, I think there's a philosophical debate here about whether we want to make sure everyone pays the same price for drugs or whether there's competition in the marketplace for paying for drugs. That's probably a fair debate. But what this bill does is basically subvert what's working in the private marketplace right now, and that's the reality that we live in right now. That's the reality that everyone who's paying for prescription drugs has to live in right now. They have to get the best price that they can. And they negotiate as best they can. They hire us to do that on their behalf. Let me point out a couple of other provisions, or at least one other provision of the bill, because it actually really works in direct contrary to one of our major efforts, which is to promote the use of generic drugs. Let me tell you, when we promote generic drugs, there are no rebates associated with generic drugs. There are no rebates that come from the manufacturers. We encourage the adoption and the promotion of generic drugs because it actually creates competition with brand name drug manufacturers and helps put price pressure on them. There's a provision in the bill that talks about drug switching. Section 151A07, dispensation of therapeutic alternative prescription drugs. There's a provision that says you can go ahead and make a generic drug substitution if it's a lower-cost generic. Now, the current state of Minnesota law is if my physician writes me a prescription, he happens to write the brand name drug on it, and they take it to the pharmacist is allowed to make that generic substitution without calling the doctor. He can ask the patient, but he doesn't have to call the doctor. He can go ahead and make that generic substitution because it's the exact same drug, exact same effectiveness, and it's less expensive. We've made a decision as a state that we want to encourage that type of public policy. The way this provision is written, even though it says I can make a generic substitution, I can suggest a generic substitution, if a generic is substituted, I now have to call the doctor, and I also have to make certain disclosures to individuals involved in it. This will frustrate efforts for generic substitution. This will greatly frustrate efforts for generic substitution for no good reason. I want to dispel another myth that PBMs are somehow locked in this cabal with drug manufacturers to try to promote drug manufactured products so that we can make secret profits on rebates. I'll tell you what, my company doesn't work that way. My company makes money when we dispense generic drugs. We actually lose money when we dispense brand name drugs in the retail pharmacy. 69% of the prescriptions that my company either fills in our mail order pharmacy or in a retail pharmacy, and we reimburse them for, 69% of them are for generic drugs. Now, look, if my business model were predicated on making money by maximizing rebates from drug manufacturers, and that's how I make money and I succeed, I'm not doing a very good job running my company because I'd want as high a possible brand name drug dispensing of brand name drugs as possible. We don't work that way. This bill eviscerates the most successful tools that the private marketplace are using right now to control their drug care costs. Look, We may have a debate sometime in the future about whether we should set drug prices or not, but I'll argue that this is not a constructive way to begin that debate. Basically, what you're doing is, let's say you're living in a house and you don't like how the house is designed right now. Okay, this bill basically suggests you should tear down that house before you know if you have a new place to live, before you know if you can build a new house, and before you know what that new house is going to look like. Look, people are struggling to afford their prescription drugs. These are the tools that are effective and are working for them in this current environment. If we want to have a debate about setting prices on drugs, let's have that debate. But let's not undercut the efforts that the private marketplace needs to use right now if they want to continue to afford this benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Roman. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, and we're going to have to give a couple of minutes to Mr. Cypra. Please go ahead.
I'm Clement Cypra. I'm Deputy Vice President of Policy for Pharma, which is the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. I represent the branded drug industry and about 30 companies at this point are pharma members. If I can just say a couple of things. One, Medicaid, it was referred that the Medicaid program is not getting the best prices. You were required under federal law to get best price. The price that Medicaid pays is always the best. I promise you that. There have been settlements enforcing that. And there have been accidents over the period where the prices have been discrepancies, but those problems are solved, and they are litigated often, or they used to be litigated often, so that is definitely the case. The other thing is that there are no drug manufacturers that own PBMs. There was one. I'll bring up the case of Merck Medco, which is the only one of its kind. There were tremendous issues. Those companies were dissolved as a relationship, I believe, in 2002. Please don't quote me on that, but it has been at least a number of years. They are entirely separate companies, and they're verboten by federal law in order to operate along this way. No pharmaceutical company also owns an insurer or anything along those lines. Different lines of business, we keep them separate. The issues of pricing are very interesting. Essentially, what you heard a lot of here is that the prices are crazy. Yes, they are set and have been historically set in a crazy fashion. AWP, which is average wholesale price, is an amalgamation of all sorts of numbers, and truth be told, it is very rarely accurate. AMP is average manufacturer price, a term that came into being about 5 years ago and is now has been reported for about the past 5 years. In 2006 or 2005, the Deficit Reduction Act, the DRA, provided that AWP is going away. AMP will become the standard. It was supposed to go into effect at the beginning of 2007. The pharmacy organizations and the generic manufacturers applied for a stay, and they received a stay from the federal government. Currently, my organizations are reporting both AWP and AMP to the federal government. And the stay will likely be lifted at the October 2009 is the time for this. I'm not a lawyer. I'm an economist. So if I mess up any of the legal terms, I apologize for it.
Thank you.
The law, just if I can do one more thing, the issue of the state not being able to access those prices is inaccurate. They are able to obtain them from the federal government. They just need to make a request to HHS. And I also would say I'll in opposition because the $275 additional fee for a manufacturer, some of whom operate in the state, but all of whom employ a lot of people, feels capricious. So I can take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cypra. I want to make sure members, we're kind of running out of time. We've talked about this for 40 minutes, but this is a bill that we already voted on. So if you wish to ask questions that may clarify your position,
please
go ahead.
Well, Madam Chair, we considered the bill, and I pulled it back before the vote last year because it was the last day of hearings.
I thought we voted.
Okay,
excuse me. But anyway, go ahead.
All right. Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Rowan, thank you for your testimony. And if you can, it's fine. But for this farm boy, if you could break it down how this bill would affect the consumer so that I can understand. This is so complicated for me. So you can break it down, because I think we should all, as elected people, be looking out for the consumer. And I'm concerned about this bill having an effect on the consumer. Could you just, use an example? I got another thing to say after you're done.
Sure. Mr. Rowan.
There are two provisions that we're primarily concerned about. And while it's hard to draw a direct nexus to an individual consumer, I'll just explain very quickly. The provision that requires us to disclose basically every page of every contract that we have with a drug manufacturer. The FTC has looked at this type of disclosure and said this is going to result in anti-competitive, collusive behavior by drug manufacturers. Because if you have two or more drug manufacturers who manufacture a drug in the same therapeutic class to treat the same condition, they now know what the competitor is charging for that drug, and they can basically engage in collusive behavior in terms of the pricing. There's no longer an incentive to compete. That's going to increase costs for my clients. One of my clients is Preferred One in this state. That's going to increase costs for Preferred One. Well, Preferred One, when their costs go up, they have to increase their premiums. Well, a lot of employers pay premiums, but a lot of employers also make individual consumers pay a portion of those premiums. So those premiums go up, those individual consumers pay more in their premiums. The other point about generic substitution, if you increase the cost and you put barriers in front of generic substitution, and right now it happens freely in the marketplace because it's understood it's a good thing, it works, there are not problems with it. This requires a disclosure and a phone call before it can happen. Generic drugs save consumers on average 30% or more on what they pay for their prescription drugs. So let's say the doctor, because he uses the term Lipitor, Lipitor is not a good example. Let's use Zocor, which is cholesterol-lowering medication. He put Zocor on the drug slip because that's what he's used to writing. But he knows Simvastatin is available in the marketplace, and that's a generic version of Zocor. He doesn't write Simvastatin, he writes Zocor. Fully understanding and knowing that unless he writes dispense as written, that person's going to get generic Zocor, Simvastatin. We're now in a situation where if he writes Zocor, it goes to the pharmacist, it says Zocor. Unless the PBM calls the doctor and unless certain disclosures are made, that person's going to get the brand name and they're going to pay a higher copayment and their employer's going to pay more than if generic Simvastatin had been dispensed to them.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, this language that he's referring to is referring to the PBMs making a switch. The pharmacist, this does not refer to the pharmacist making a switch, which is allowed under current law. He's correct about that, but this only talks about if the PBM is requesting the switch of a lower-priced generic. This is not – the difficulty with this whole issue is that when you talk about competition, there is no competition in this field, or it's such a bizarre competition that you have pricing disparities. There have been a lawsuit a number of years ago showed 12-to-1 price disparities for the same drug. 30-day supply of a certain heart medication, I recall, $4 for some payers, $48 for others. That's not a competitive market. It's simply because you have these kickbacks, they call them rebates, but undisclosed payments, it's such a Byzantine kind of pricing scheme that you don't know what's going on where. And the whole gist of this is to make sure we can enforce a law that says you can't charge some people more, other than you can have the competition, the retail competition. If Walgreens buys more than small drugstores, the small drugstores can get together and bulk purchase them. But it's not the way this market works right now. And when you get a bill from from buying a prescription, says your copayment is say $20, and it says this drug costs $43, whatever it says it costs, that might be what the drugstore is selling it for, but it's not what the health plan's paying. They may be paying a fraction of that much after, because they get the rebate. Either the PBM or the health plan gets the rebate. So the system is all confused. So it shouldn't be hard to understand why it's a confusing thing. But his point on the rebates the generic substitution was not dealing with the pharmacist substitution.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corey.
Then if you have, and I'm not just picking on Blue Cross Blue Shield, but if Blue Cross Blue Shield negotiates with Brainerd Medical Center on let's say state employees and their health care coverage, they negotiate a reimbursement rate for the people that are in that plan. I don't understand what's wrong with that. Let's say the clinic says, okay, we charge $120 for an office call, and Blue Cross Blue Shield says, we're going to pay you $60. They have a contractual agreement with them, And it seems to me that this is the same thing that's happening here, is a contractual agreement, and now we're telling them that they can't have right or not?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, the law from 1973 says you cannot price discriminate on prescription drugs other than wholesale, period. It makes it clear that you can't discriminate. It says unfair discrimination shall embrace any scheme of special rebates, collateral contacts, or any device of any nature which in substance violates the provisions of the subdivision. In other words, any scheme, whether it's by a PBM or a drug manufacturer or anyone, you cannot have that. Part of the reason for that trouble is that, again, if you don't have prescription drug coverage, which is about half the people in the state, you are paying sometimes 10 times as much as others. The point is, if we have a same price, that they have to go down to the price that's negotiated. If we expose the prices, if the Attorney General and everyone has the ability to enforce the law, we can get a fair price for people. But we don't have that now.
Senator Prentice-Allen wanted
Madam
to say
Chair,
something.
Madam Chair, and Senator Coring, in response to your question, too, about hospital or provider costs, the providers in the hospital, we already have transparency laws that require them to make their prices available. And we also know how much they're being reimbursed by the insurer and the copay by the patient. So all of that transparency is available to us.
I guess I'd like to hear from Mr. Rowan.
Senator Coring, please go ahead and ask.
I guess I'd like to hear from what he has to say, Mr.
Yeah.
Rowan.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, there's a lot of confusion about transparency, and what was just described is a very different level of transparency than what's being discussed in this bill, particularly with the PBM provision requiring us to disclose our manufacturer contracts. You're absolutely right. Hospitals have to disclose what prices they charge customers that come into their hospital that use their services, and it's generally known what they're being reimbursed. That's not the analogy here. The analogy here would be the hospital also having to disclose all of its input contracts. Its contracts with its doctors, its contracts with its nurses, its contracts with its suppliers, its contracts with device makers, all of those. That's the cost, that's the analogous cost basis here. That's a different level of transparency than what was discussed.
Senator Prentice.
And Madam Chair, all that information is disclosed during rebasing of the hospitals.
Okay, members, we're going to have to move on. I know that Senator Hand, you have a question.
Well, yes, and Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. And I understand that we did have a hearing a year or so ago on this bill, and we didn't take a vote. But I am a little bit concerned when we have a number of bills that all are very complex and have controversy, and the idea is, well, we're going to hear them for 10 minutes and pass them. If we're going to do that, why don't we just not have the hearing? Why don't we just vote and pass them, and the majority can do whatever they want? But if the purpose is to understand what we're doing, then it'll take some time. And as was made a statement made by Mr. Weiberg earlier on, that one of the things he said is that this stuff is very complex. That was a direct quote he said, very complex. And what we're talking about here is trying to figure out how to manage a very complicated pricing mechanism that is essentially in the marketplace. And I don't know how many people around this table or in this room have actually worked in businesses where they've set prices. I have done that in a food manufacturing business, which is far less complicated than the pharmaceutical industry. And Senator Marty may call it a scheme, but there are no easy pricing mechanisms that are devised. It's not a simple thing. There's lots of complexity to it. And I think that for us to say, well, we're going to just have a 10-minute hearing and pass this because we think that somebody is doing something that's unfair. My point earlier on this law, why it's not enforceable. If these provisions applied to any other business in the state, there would be no business in the state. These kinds of provisions are not enforceable because they cannot be enforceable if you want to have competition. You cannot require people doing business to disclose everything about their business to everybody else and expect that you're going to have any competitive work at all. I do want to point out, and just generally, I got some information from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services that says that in 2007, prescription drug spending growth reached a historic low, 4.9%, the lowest since 1963. prescription drug prices in 2007 grew only 1.4%. 2006 and 7, only 8% of the total healthcare spending was attributed to prescription medicine. So here we have a very small portion of the total healthcare cost that has not been growing, has not been even growing at the rate of inflation, and we're going to impose a regimen that would essentially shut it down because we say that it's out of control and it's too costly and it's not efficient. And we're going to impose a price mechanism that I would argue none of us in this room understands. I don't understand it. I don't understand what this bill would do because I don't think that the way it's drafted, I think that they understand what the consequences of what they're asking to do. This is a danger that we should recognize generally when we're trying to set pricing mechanisms for large, complicated market interactions. And we ought to be very careful about this, and I think especially in the healthcare industry. Unless, as was mentioned, if we want to say, well, let's just go away from the market altogether and turn it over to legislatures and set prices and do all that, that's certainly a philosophical approach that we can take. But if we're not going to do that, then we ought to let something that's working very well continue to work. And so, Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I object to the haste by which we're trying to get through this. I think what we ought to do is have a very thorough discussion, since we're going to get into this, about economics and about pricing before we have any action on any of these bills. That would probably be more instructive to the members of the committee. If we're going to be making economic decisions about how prices are set and how they should be set, then we ought to have a pretty lengthy tutorial about that generally, and I don't think we've done that. So I don't know, Madam Chair, if we want to go ahead and have a vote, we will, but I think that we're not being well served. The public isn't being well served.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Pernicell.
Although both of these bills have had significant airings in the past, I also respect the request for further information, and I would be willing to lay this over, and maybe there will be time later in the meeting to bring it up again.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Marty.
And Madam Chair, I concur with what Senator Hand said about it being complex and so on. The only thing I would disagree about with what you said was you said the system right now is working pretty good, because it's not. But again, this is a very complex system, and I don't know that we took their word, people who were not here at those hearings, and I think it is a complex issue, and so I think Senator Pretner-Sowen's right, and you're right, we should put it over. So I support just laying it on the table.
Senator, this is your bill, so Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the authors, I would just say this, and actually to Senator Hand, too. This committee is not economics committee, and I think maybe some of the economics of the bill could be discussed in another committee. However, in terms of the policy, the healthcare policy piece, I think it's real appropriate for us to talk about here. And we very well may have a difference of opinion on the policy piece. And frankly, my opinion is that healthcare is not a commodity to be sold to the highest bidder. And we should get some constraints put on the pricing and equalization of medications out there. If you have medications that are being sold 10 times the amount or 1,000 times the amount, as we've heard testimony, I mean, that's not appropriate, and it's not correct for the people of the state of Minnesota. They deserve medications that are fairly priced, and I support the bill.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Corian and Senator Hand.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And just one comment I'd have to say is, you know, looking at the agenda here, the people that were in favor of it, of this bill, are somebody from the Attorney General's office and Mr. Weiberg. He's shaking his head no. And so I guess normally we see a whole groundswell of people that are saying, oh, we got to get this changed. This has got to be changed. I guess I'd like to hear, Senator Marty, I'd like to hear from these people. I don't turn anybody away at my office. I'd like to hear from this groundswell of people that think that we need to change this, because I guess I'm not seeing it, you know. So that's what I'd ask you to do, you know, and if you can convince me, you know, I keep an open mind. So I guess that's what I'd like to hear, rather than somebody from the Attorney General's office, when you haven't had a case at all. I just kind of question whether we need that or not. So
I'm sorry I didn't give the chance to Senator Lynch because I was looking in this direction. So Senator Lynch had a comment. Please go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Only just for inquiry, is there a motion on the table before us?
I was going to ask Senator Prednisolone if she has a motion.
Madam Chair, I'd suggest the chair just lay it over. But I would comment to Senator Corey, and that's what we had the hearing in December and last March where we had the testimony. We did not bring in the advocates today. Mr. Weiberg, to explain some of how the system works, and the Attorney General's office, explain how the fact that this law has never been enforced because nobody's had the ability to enforce it.
Senator Prednisolone, would you like to reinstate your motion to lay this over?
No, there's no motion, Madam Chair. Okay. We just want to lay the table
over. We're going to lay it
over
for further discussion. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty, you're next.
Can we take up Senate File 1237 now?
Yes. Please go ahead.
And Madam Chair, I have an A4 amendment to the bill that I'd like to offer, and I'll explain
the
point of that amendment.
We don't have a copy of that amendment yet.
It's being distributed.
Senator, so she's passing it around.
And Madam Chair, this is an author's amendment, so I don't, but I want to explain it ahead of time, the reason for it. The first page and a half of this amendment, up to line 2.18, is simply replacing the disclosure language in Section 1 of Senate File 1237. And let me go first by explaining this is a bill that would ban gifts from drug manufacturers and medical device manufacturers to physicians. And this language at the top is designed to mirror a possible bill, a bill in Washington by Senator Grassley, a sunshine bill on disclosure of any gift giving that's allowed. And so this is an attempt to copy what the federal government is talking about, because the industry says, oh, they don't mind the federal disclosure standards. The other amendments in the bill are to address concerns we've been hearing and talking with the industry. And the only one I wanted to point out, none of those need particularly to be pointed out, but the rest of them are changes that were meant to address some of the concerns we've heard in recent weeks. So I'd move the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Senator Marty. All of those in favor of the A4 amendment signifying by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Marty.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, restrictions on gifts from pharmaceutical manufacturers and medical device manufacturers to health practitioners, particularly doctors, has been growing concern around the country. Been a lot of attention paid to it in the media. A lot of the health plans. Park Nicollet has imposed its own restrictions. Blue Cross has. I think Park Nicollet actually has a letter in the packets right now in support of the bill. Dr. Sarah at the University of Minnesota has been working on this, St. Mary's Duluth Clinic. Lots of places are doing it on their own. Medical students feel very strongly about this issue. Senator Dave Dern, former Senator Durenberger and current Senator Klobuchar have both been very active and supportive of banning and restricting the gifts from the industry to providers. And there's a reason for this, because there's a conflict of interest. We recognized it in Minnesota, I think it was in 1995, where we passed the first in the nation prescription drug manufacturer gift ban, where they could not give gifts to doctors. But unfortunately, that bill had many loopholes in, and Senator Berglund, who's been involved in this, was, I think, you were expressing surprise at certain gifts that members of the committee were discussing last year were still allowed because you knew we had a gift ban. But there have been many loopholes in it. And I started taking interest in this again in 2006. There's an article in, I believe it's in your packets, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Health Industry Practices That Create Conflicts of Interest. It's by a couple of Harvard medical school doctors and people from Columbia University, about 10 doctors from various schools around the country. And I'm going to just quote from one little page of it, the second page of it. The standing of the profession, meaning the medical profession, as much as the integrity of the pharmaceutical and medical device industries, is jeopardized by by allowing obvious conflicts of interest to continue. The serious threat that this state of affairs poses for professionalism and for the trust that patients have in physicians makes the need for effective guidelines on industry-physician relationships both apparent and urgent. Marketing and market value should not be allowed to undermine physicians' commitment to their patients' best interest and to scientific integrity. And that article goes on to point out the two myths. One is that disclosure is sufficient. They say that's not the case. And number two, that small gifts do not make a difference. And in your packet, there's an article from a piece of information from Prescription Project on why small gifts matter. And I think St. Mary's Duluth Clinic made national headlines when they plowed through the, they actually gained all the pens and thermometers and everything else they had were coming from the pharmaceutical industry as marketing devices, and they gathered them all up, and so they were banning them. And frankly, as I mentioned, they and Park Nicollet and some others are going ahead and trying to do this. But there is a very important need to address this, and it does two things. One, it helps reduce the cost of prescription drugs for the state, for health plans, for everyone. And I think that's the reason that the university and a lot of the health plans are very interested in this legislation. But we want to move forward, and I'll go through the bill very quickly. Section 1, as amended, is using basically language from Senator Grassley's Sunshine Bill on disclosure. Any agreements, any financial transactions, gift types of things from pharmaceutical manufacturers have to be reported to the commissioner. And Section 2 takes our existing gift to practitioner law. You can see it's gifts to practitioners prohibited. And we expand it in two ways. One, to include medical device manufacturers and distributors, and we tighten up the restrictions on it. We put in a definition of gift because the medical device industry was concerned about that. And then under the exceptions, we added a new exception based on a concern of Epilepsy Foundation saying, you know, sometimes doctors give under free samples, sometimes doctors will provide a two-week course of medication for a patient to try it, like with epilepsy, if they're trying several different ones. So we'd be allowing it for that. Also, if we'd be allowing it for uninsured and low-income patients, if there's evidence to suggest that it is a drug that's better than cheaper alternatives. We would tighten up we'd remove the $50 limit, the $50 amount that is any gifts below that are exempt. We would tighten up the grants to medical conferences to make it clear that the industry, when they're sponsoring a medical conference, can have no influence on the content, presenters, or attendance. We would tighten up on their compensation, the honoraria, and payment to practitioners who serve in faculty at professional conferences, so it wouldn't exceed the reasonable professional compensation of the practitioner, which can be thousands of dollars a day, but it would be based on the profession. The drug companies could not pay you $20,000 to give an hour, two-hour speech. It would have to be based on your standard billing rates. Same thing if they're going to compensate for consulting and professional services. And that's important because we want to continue. Doctors have to be able to work with pharmaceutical companies, in particular medical device manufacturers, to work on their devices. You want that connection to continue, but we're saying that they have to compensate them at no more than what would be a reasonable professional compensation based on it. So a heart surgeon may have much higher compensation for using them, but the point is we don't want to step on legitimate consulting research work that's being done. But then the addition to these restrictions, these exemptions, we also, and we added several other exemptions like the eighth one on page 3, line 8, a reasonable compensation for intellectual property or patent royalties. If you're involved in device manufacturing design, that you could get compensated for that. training, other things are exempted from it. So we're expanding some of the exemptions from this. We're tightening up on some of the others. But the bottom line is we'd make it, we would make it so our gift ban actually is a gift ban with the exceptions of things where people are legitimately being compensated for legitimate things. And then finally, the last section of the bill, the State Drug Formulary Committee, we're just saying that if you're going to serve on the Drug Formulary Committee, that you could not accept a gift or professional samples from a drug manufacturer, and you cannot be an employee or an agent of a drug manufacturer. If you're going to serve on the formulary committee for DHS that determines what drugs are available in the public program. Again, I can bring in, I have one witness here, but I also wanted to say we've had witnesses on this before, but this is a major problem, and the industry spends a fortune on this. They spend $100 million a year in Minnesota direct-to-consumer advertising, and they spend a lot more marketing directly to doctors. And the whole point of it, the reason they're spending money and giving it to doctors, spending money on courting doctors on this, is because it changes their prescribing practice. And Senator Dahl's bill later will get at one way of how they do that. With that, I'm happy to stand for questions. I also have Don Jacobs, who's here to testify on behalf of the bill.
Thank you, Senator. And you also have, I think, six people who would like to testify. Senator Corian.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Marty, I want to give you an example of what happened to me, and then I want to know if this bill affects that. Shortly after I got elected, probably about 6 months after I got elected, I developed acid reflux. I don't know if it was because of the job or what, but so I've been taking Protonix for 5.5 years. I recently went into my pharmacist to get a refill, and they did the pharmacy benefit manager, went on the computer, and they said that they could no longer do the Protonix. They had to do something different, I guess a generic. And he said, I can't give you anything until you go back and see your doctor, and then he prescribes it. Okay. Well, if I don't take that pill, it is really bad. And so the pharmacist gave me a week's worth of samples, and it wasn't Protonix, it was something else to help. Would this bill say that they can't do that, or that the manufacturer couldn't give the pharmacist those samples? And then, because if I wouldn't have had those samples, I would have been in big trouble, because it was on a Friday afternoon and had the whole weekend to go. And so would this bill affect that? Or?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, first of all, two things. One, it's not a physician benefit, and it's not a PBM doing that. That's your pharmacist telling you. And I don't know if the reason they're telling you can't get that one refilled is because the plan changed its formulary and it's not on that. I presume that's probably the most likely thing, which is something I have problems with that concept here in our health system, but that's not part of this bill. But in terms of the samples, I'm not aware of pharmacists getting sample gifts, and this bill deals with
Mr. Weiberg would like
Weiberg
to
speak
help with
to that because I'm not
answer.
Sure
what welcome happened back to the committee, Mr. Weiberg.
I hope I didn't get somebody in trouble.
I was, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Coring, actually my colleague from DHS and I were just joking. She asked if I wanted the pharmacist's name.
No.
The pharmacist probably did not give you a drug sample in the terms that we're talking about here. Congress passed a law back in 1987 called the Prescription Drug Marketing Act, mm-hmm. and since that law went into effect, pharmaceutical manufacturers have not been able to distribute samples to pharmacists. There was too much of a concern that the samples were getting diverted into the gray market. In fact, I know some older pharmacists who tell me of the days when they used to take some of the hard-coated tablets in a little acetone and wipe the word sample off the tablet and then turn around and sell it. So I think probably what happened, and as a former practicing pharmacist myself, this is what I frequently did in a situation like that, is the pharmacist may have given you enough to last until the situation could be resolved out of their stock, but they should not have been giving you sample. And I would hazard to guess that, and if I could ask you a question, did it come in a prescription vial or did it come in a box marked sample? Because if it's a sample, it should have been marked sample. And if they actually did it, then maybe I would need to check to see who that pharmacist
is. No, I don't want to get, Madam Chair, I don't want to get my pharmacist in trouble. But okay. What if they were, did they get samples that are not, that are like over-the-counter samples?
That could also be what happened, Madam Chair, Senator Cornyn, that could be also what happened in this case. There are over-the-counter alternatives to protonics.
And that would be okay.
Well, in that case, it's still not, I'm still not sure that it's samples, but they may have given you that as well.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Cornyn. I know Senator Higgins had a question, but she had to go. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I was at your meeting in the fall or December, whenever that was, and I had a lot of questions surrounding this particular area. One of the things that I'm hoping that we'll hear today, Senator Marty, is at that hearing, we heard that pharma had some new regulations that were going to be going into effect in 2009. So I'm hoping that we hear a little bit more about that. At that hearing, I also think that there was I was led to believe that there would be ongoing and continued discussions between the author and the pharmacy constituency working collectively. So I'm interested to see or hear more about those discussions. I hope that we hear a little bit today about how this legislation in Minnesota before us might play with the legislation that's being proposed by Senator Grassley. And my question with regard to your specific legislation is, and I was trying to follow with your amendment and what's actually in the bill, but Senator Marty, if you look at the, if I would reference the act, the original, your bill, on lines 2.10, that's where we're talking about the samples. And I'm trying to figure out where the amendment fits in with that. I'm concerned. I, for one, think that the professional samples provided, as you've noted in your original language, are a good thing. And I'm not sure that that has been maintained with your amendment, if you could comment.
Yeah. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I'll try and respond to, first of all, yes, we have met with a number of groups, including the device manufacturers and so on, about the bill and tried to address concerns. There are disagreements, but tried to address concerns. Number two, you mentioned pharma has a voluntary code they put in place. They will describe it as tough. I think most of the advocates will describe it as weak. Better than nothing, but not much. And in terms of the samples, first of all, the new language is supposed to be, I believe, at the end of that clause on page 2, line 11. I didn't check where it fits in, but I think that's where, that's right, it marked in. In terms of the samples, a lot of growing number of health plans and others, I think Park Nicollet very much limits where they can be used. A lot of others are, because the reason for the samples is not to get people to get good low-priced drugs or drugs for free. The reason, and what's often been happening, we have, I think it was testimony in front of the committee in December where people have seen, doctors have seen patients who are prescribed a very expensive drug, or they've got a whether it's heart disease or something. The sample they're given is a very expensive drug. Sample runs out. They don't refill the prescription because they can't afford it. When there's a cheap, not a generic, but a similar drug that might be $4 a month instead of $200 a month, that would accomplish virtually the same thing. And because the doctor gave them the one, they try and fill the prescription for that drug, and it costs them a lot more, which is why a lot of the medical plans, a lot of the researchers involved in this are opposed, a lot of doctors are opposed to the free samples. I'm not sure if SMDC in Duluth has stopped sampling, but I know some of the plans have been putting very great restrictions on it because the industry's not doing this. They're not spending hundreds of millions of dollars out of the generosity of their heart. That's what they'll tell you they're doing, but they're often prescribing drugs, they're not encouraging the use of inexpensive drugs. They're picking their top drugs, and they're the ones they're marketing. They're the ones they're using the sampling of. But I'd be glad to get into that more later because I'm sure that will come up further.
Thank you. Senator Pernis-Owen has a question, and then we will go to the witness.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, no, just verification that SMDC does not accept samples.
Does not accept them?
Yes.
Thank you, Senator. Please proceed with, welcome to the committee and identify yourself. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Don Jacobs. I'm Chairman and CEO of Hennepin Faculty Associates. Thank you for the invitation to address this group today. I will be testifying for two bills, this bill also for Senate File 895, a little bit later, establishment of a prescription drug education program, and I hope to make a connection between the two. I enthusiastically support this proposed gift ban legislation. This legislation will bring much-needed transparency to the financial relationships that exist between physicians and the healthcare industry. I'll give you my personal perspective, developed as a physician and healthcare leader for the past 35 years. I practiced general surgery in this community for almost 32 years, and for the past 9 years have been in my CEO role of a 320-physician academic practice. I've loved my role as caregiver, teacher, researcher, and now leader. I've been thrilled to be a part of an important and honorable profession. And have witnessed firsthand remarkable changes in the scientific foundations of medicine with the development of amazing new drugs and devices that have markedly enhanced our abilities to treat disease, repair injury, and relieve suffering. Many thousands of physicians have partnered with industry to develop these new treatments and will continue to do so in the future. Yet the effort of industry to influence physicians' behaviors through financial means should give us some pause. There is no doubt that substantial sums of money can induce physicians to drift across the gray line between collaboration to support the best care for patients and supporting the financial interests of the physician. Such overt actions, from my personal perch, have been very rare and are by no means confined to the healthcare profession. Our current economic crisis has at its roots both egregious and subtle financial self-interest unchecked by any reasonable transparency. I believe the vast majority of physicians are dedicated, principled, and intentionally avoid financial entanglements with industry. Their dedication to their patients, their willingness to sacrifice time with their families to be at a patient's bedside, and their efforts to improve themselves and the system in which we work make many of them truly heroic. Nonetheless, serious conflicts of interest are widespread. Whether intentionally or not, developed over several decades by the reimbursement systems in healthcare and the marketing genius within industry, many physicians have become marketing tools of industry's promotional efforts. Some have engaged in pseudoscientific studies, published biased articles, and educational materials that foster industry goals over patient goals. As Jerome Kasser, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, once wrote, "Clinical advice, like votes, should never be bought." I'll admit I have sinned. I have practiced medicine and been at this trough and sit in a very different place now and understand the difficulties it creates. These issues have been discussed widely for the past 20 years, yet we have made little progress. The financial stakes are high. Yet we know conclusively that gifts, even small ones, and payments such as meals, travel, consulting, and speaking fees have been shown to influence medical decisions and increase health care costs. The public is justifiably concerned about the hidden financial relationships between industry and the medical profession. And that brings me back to this bill. This bill builds on Minnesota's leadership as one of the first states with pharmaceutical manufacturer reporting laws. This bill very importantly extends that transparency to our relationships with the medical device industry and supply manufacturers. And finally, this bill will give the patients, the public, practitioners, and healthcare organizations more complete and relevant information about caregivers' relationships with industry and allow for better informed choices about their care. We all need and deserve that kind of transparency. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Senator Marty, I think you have a few people.
Madam Chair, there are a number of witnesses in opposition to the bill.
Yes, and we need to call them. And I hope I don't I'm not running the risk of saying that we're going to move this really fast because I have a political agenda. But it's just that we have to come back tonight, Senator Hahn. So I'm going to ask the witness to please come to the table. We have Mr. Clark, Mr. Gerhardt, Mr. Arndt, Ms. Arndt, and Ms. Wolf, and Mr. Cyper again. Welcome to the committee, and if you could please introduce yourself, and maybe we can start.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Gerhardt. I'm the CEO of Life Science Alley, a trade association here in the state representing nearly 600 organizations. Those organizations employ about 250,000 Minnesotans, and many of those organizations and companies are locally headquartered medical device, pharmaceutical, and biotech companies. These companies range in size from small startups to major multinational organizations that devote their efforts to the research, development, and commercialization of life science products and services. These developers, and the manufacturers employ more than 50,000 high-wage skilled jobs here in Minnesota. I'm appearing before you today to express concerns our organization has regarding SF 1237. In raising concerns about this legislation, we do not intend to minimize serious concerns about the need for transparency and appropriate disclosure of relationships between medical device and pharmaceutical companies and physicians. We know Senator Marty is sincere in his desire to address these issues and appreciate the time he and his staff have spent listening and trying to address our concerns. Our reason for appearing before the committee is to urge the legislature to use caution and to carefully examine all of the consequences of the bill before you. Four quick points. First, Life Science Alley supports a federal solution to prevent 50 state regulations and compliance schemes. Lack of consistency among the 50 states will drive up healthcare costs and could very negatively impact Minnesota's competitiveness as a world leader in medical technology and life sciences. This could result in shifting of resources, revenue, and jobs to other states without bans. In addition, most of our Minnesota-based medical device and pharmaceutical biotech companies are small companies employing less than 100 people. These small companies employ at least as many Minnesotans as the larger companies operating in the state. Most of these companies are in a complex and difficult world of participating in a national and world market, responding and dealing with extremely intense and complex oversight from federal regulatory agencies and keeping their life-saving products at highest quality. Having to navigate compliance in multiple states would be a significant burden for them. Federal physician sunshine legislation is being developed by Senators Grassley and Coles. Senator Amy Klobuchar has stated that she intends to be an author. We support a federal solution because it creates a uniform compliance environment and would prevent states without restrictions from stealing conferences, training, and research and development companies. The federal legislation will also address most of the components of the Minnesota legislation. Second, we understand Senator Marty's target is inappropriate marketing practices. The issue of being addressed is very complex. This legislation would expand the scope of the gift ban to include medical devices. We would be only the second state, as we understand it, to include devices in that gift ban. The development of medical devices is different from pharmaceuticals and biologics. Medical device companies must rely on physician experience and feedback to develop better treatments for patients. An example of that is Digimed, the company that was featured just this morning, that worked its way through with Hennepin County Medical Center organization with a local engineering company to develop a wonderful new orthopedic product. If they could not work closely with the physician on that, it would not have happened. While we appreciate Senator Marty's inclusion of exceptions in Subdivision 3, Sections 7 and 8 to address these concerns, these sections also raise questions. What are reasonable expenses? And we still have a very difficult time understanding what the changes have been made. We don't understand how those would be calculated either. What happens in situations where a practitioner is not connected with a patent but is providing substantial services in connection with the development of device? Other sections of the bill also raise questions, i.e., what is the standard hourly billing rate? And again, we understand that there's revised language and have questions about that. This legislation would also apply to preclinical and early stage companies who are not yet marketing products. They should be exempt. To quote a local executive of a startup device company, small companies cannot afford any more regulatory burden. We are literally on life support. Chairman Marty, we really appreciate your willingness to listen to our small companies. We know several of them have talked with you, and we appreciate your response to them. Nonetheless, even with modifications made to the legislation since introduction last year, our member companies are still significantly concerned that this legislation will make it extremely difficult to continue to operate in Minnesota. Thirdly, Minnesota has already adopted the strictest gift ban legislation in the country for pharmaceutical companies. This law, combined with the federal criminal and anti-kickback statutes and other criminal and civil provisions, make this legislation really unnecessarily and duplicative. Finally, Life Science Alley understands this is a very important issue for the integrity of our life science community, the medical device and pharmaceutical industry, the University of Minnesota, and certain local hospitals are all undertaking voluntary disclosure initiatives. Medtronic has announced that it will voluntarily disclose its relationships. Both AdvaMed, which represents device manufacturers nationally, and Pharma have developed codes of conduct that have been recently updated. The state of Minnesota is making significant investment in new drug and research through the Minnesota Partnership for Medical Genomics and Biotechnology, the Biomedical Bonding Authority, and other organizations. We believe state or legislation would hamper the commercialization of that research and make Minnesota unattractive to outside groups that would seek to partner with our research institutions. For the health of our medical device industry and developing biopharmaceutical industry, I urge you to support federal legislation to address this issue. Thank you for this opportunity to share with our concerns regarding SF 1237.
Thank you, Mr. Gerhardt. Please. Great.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee for providing me the opportunity to speak to you today regarding Senate File 1237. My name is Rob Clark. I'm the Senior Director of State Government Affairs at Medtronic, and I, along with my colleague Cindy Arndt, who is a Director of Compliance at Medtronic, are here today to testify to you. Considering the topic of today's hearing, it's fitting to point out that our company was founded more than 60 years ago in North Minneapolis. Sorry about that. In North Minneapolis through the joint collaboration of an engineer named Earl Bakken and a University of Minnesota physician named Walt Lillehei. That type of industry-physician collaboration remains fundamental to our company today, which has now grown to include more than 38,000 employees around the world. In addition, we estimate that we have joint collaborations with an estimated 5,000 healthcare experts across virtually all medical specialties. We're proud of these collaborations as they result in the Medtronic medical technologies that now save or enhance the lives of a patient somewhere in the world every 5 seconds. First, I want to commend Chairman Marty as well for recognizing the importance of this issue and the need for transparency in this in these relationships. Like Senator Marty, we believe patients must have trust in their physicians and the impartial judgment that those physicians employ when recommending treatment decisions. However, we do not believe that state law is the best vehicle to accomplish this important task, and so I ask for the committee's opposition to this Senate File 1237. While Medtronic has been and continues to be a proponent of transparency and disclosure of physician and industry relationships, we believe this bill is unnecessary and could serve to severely limit medical technology investment, innovation, research, and education in our home state of Minnesota. First, we believe that a national standard modeled on the legislation offered by Senators Grassley and Cole in Washington, D.C., is the most appropriate vehicle to bring transparency to these relationships. Most importantly, a uniform national standard will bring consistency and ease of accessibility to patients and others who seek this information. Today, there are more than 7 proposed state bills seeking some form of gift ban and disclosure on the medical device industry, and many more impacting the pharmaceutical industry. Each of them defines recipients, gifts, and activities and other activities differently. Each of them has different disclosure requirements. Each of them is administered by different agencies, and each of them has differing timelines to be in compliance. It is this type of patchwork that will increase complexity, drive up ambiguity on what is acceptable by all parties, and ultimately drive up compliance costs for industry that will be passed on to the healthcare system. We believe all of this can be avoided by a national standard. That is why we were the first medical device company to endorse the Grassley-Cole bill last year, and we will continue to work for passage of this type of legislation again this year. It's also important not to lose sight of the important voluntary actions the industry has taken to bring greater transparency to the efforts. First, industry manufacturers voluntarily subscribe to the AdvaMed Code of Ethics, which was mentioned. Of note is that the code now prohibits the giving of small gifts, such as pens and other promotional items. Secondly, Medtronic announced on February 24th that we will be voluntarily disclosing consulting payments made to U.S. physicians on our website beginning in March 2011 for activity occurring in 2010. Medtronic will disclose consulting agreements related to counsel provided in areas such as education and training, clinical trial design, and product design and safety. The information will be audited by a third party and the results of the audit released to the public. And third, Medtronic has been disclosing on its website all donations that have been made to U.S. customers or organizations affiliated with our customers since May 1, 2008. These types of voluntary manufacturer efforts should also be considered in the context of other voluntary reporting efforts, like those being undertaken by hospitals such as Park Nicollet and Cleveland Clinic, which was mentioned earlier, and leading academic medical centers such as Stanford, Harvard, and others. I also wanted to point out to the committee the extensive business conduct standards we require our employees to adhere to, as well as the extensive training programs our employees and managers undergo to ensure compliance with the AdvaMed Code and our own business conduct standards. Training and compliance programs of this type are customary in the industry. I've provided copies of some of those materials to you. Most importantly, we believe that these policies and these training programs balance the appropriate need for industry and medical professionals to collaborate in a legitimate manner to advance technologies while preventing unnecessary and unethical activities. This bill raises doubt on the permissibility of certain interactions that are vital to our work. For example, there's no accommodation in this bill for providing physicians and certain practitioners modest travel, meals, and lodging associated with bona fide research, consulting, and training activities. It's necessary that industry provide training and education on the safe and effective use of medical devices, which are often quite complex. And, in fact, we do that. We provide that training as part of the servicing of our products. In these instances, physicians are often required to travel to industry training centers like those we have in Moundsview and other locations in the Twin Cities and around the country. I will just say in closing here that we agree with what appears to be the intent of this legislation. And by the way, we're happy to take questions on more of the specifics of the bill because there are many more. But in the interest of time, I just want to say that we agree with the principle and the intent of the legislation. However, we believe this objective is best achieved through existing voluntary codes and a national compliance and reporting program that's being considered in Congress.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Wolf, please.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Wolf, and I am the Manager of State Government Relations for Boston Scientific Corporation. I'm joined here today by our Chief Compliance Officer, Kathy Lundberg. Should you have any questions about the complexities of costs of implementing this type of disclosure requirement for a company the size of Boston Scientific? We appreciate the opportunity to comment on Senate File 1237. And while we, too, applaud the efforts and the intent of this legislation and fully support greater transparency and adherence to high ethical standards in our interactions with healthcare practitioners, we are concerned that this legislation will impede or hinder the innovative and collaborative clinical process that is at the heart of medical device development. Boston Scientific is a global Fortune 500 company focused on innovative medical devices and procedures. Our mission is to improve the quality of patient care and the productivity of healthcare delivery through the development and advocacy of less invasive medical devices and procedures. We accomplish this by continually refining our existing products and developing new technologies that are designed to reduce risk, trauma, cost, and procedure time. Boston Scientific is a leader in the medical device industry, and we employ more than 6,000 people in the state of Minnesota who produce thousands of medical products, including cardiac stents, pacemakers, implantable defibrillators, wireless patient management systems. The products we manufacture are used by doctors all over the world to help their patients receive the life-saving care that they need. The employees we hire are highly educated and well-trained. In an industry study, Minnesota device industry employees earn 21% higher wages than the statewide average. Boston Scientific facilities are located in St. Paul, Maple Grove, and Plymouth, Minnesota, and our three campuses cover more than 2.5 million square feet. Employees engaged in manufacturing earn an average salary of $38,967, and employees conducting research and development earn nearly $62,600 on average. Since 2002, the Boston Scientific Foundation has awarded $1.3 million worth of grants to 79 charitable organizations in the Twin Cities area, all of which focus on improving health or education for the underserved. Many of the benefits provided by our company and our industry are indirect. These indirect benefits have a multiplier effect on employment and wages in Minnesota. For example, for each job in the medical technology industry, it's estimated that more than three additional jobs are created in the state. Boston Scientific, who's obviously headquartered in Massachusetts, has three times as many employees in Minnesota as we do in our home state, and we are committed to continued innovation in the state of Minnesota among some of the world's top scientists and healthcare providers. But we urge you to vote no on a bill that could have a chilling effect on the life sciences industry and discourage future investment in Minnesota. Our home state of Massachusetts did become the first state in the nation to require the medical device industry to disclose allowable payments to healthcare practitioners. And as a company headquartered in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we are acutely aware of the negative unintended consequences that come from this type of legislation designed largely to regulate the pharmaceutical industry. The medical device industry is far different from the pharmaceutical industry. Our research and development process is complex and one of sensitive, hands-on collaboration between physicians, engineers, scientists, and device companies, and it must be protected from potentially damaging and premature disclosure requirements. In contrast, healthcare practitioners are rarely involved in the actual creation of new chemical compounds that become tomorrow's pharmaceutical breakthroughs, making attempts to force fit two very different industries into the same set of regulations fundamentally unworkable. The newly enacted Massachusetts gift ban and disclosure law created such uncertainty and disruption in the innovative clinical process that the number of new clinical trials initiated in Massachusetts and registered on clinicaltrials.gov, an NIH-sponsored website by the federal government, was cut in half in January 2009 over the previous January 2008. And further, the 8,000-member American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology canceled a 2015 conference in Boston to avoid confusion and the possibility of incurring steep fines for inadvertent violations of the new law. The Boston Chamber of Commerce estimates that losses in state and local revenues and taxes as a direct result of this new law could be well over $100 million during the next few years. Minnesota is home to more medical device companies and employees than any other state in the country, and it is both unnecessary and economically dangerous to consider this type of legislation during these uncertain economic times. This bill would put Minnesota at a competitive and regulatory disadvantage over other states without a gift ban, seeking to build a similarly robust life sciences industry in one of the few remaining growth sectors in the American economy. Our industry association, AdvaMed, mentioned before, has recently updated their code of conduct to ban all non-essential or non-educational gifts, like coffee mugs and mouse pads, to providers and the provision of all but modest and occasional meals accompanied by an educational presentation is prohibited.
Ms. Wolf, I would like to ask if you could please expedite your testimony. We
sure.
need to end.
Boston Scientific and dozens of other AdvaMed device companies have voluntarily adopted this code of conduct, as Rob mentioned before, and we too support the Physician Payment Sunshine Act sponsored by Senators Grassley and Cole. The gift ban and disclosure provisions of Senate File 1237 are largely duplicative and harmful to an industry that is critical to the Minnesota economy and dedicated to improving patients' lives. Should this legislation advance, our main concerns lie in the disclosure requirements this bill seeks to impose that could derail preclinical collaborations and genuine clinical research in Minnesota and force disclosure of largely intangible and immaterial information. We're clear in the intent of the legislation to restrict and make transparent companies' sales and marketing activities that could impact providers' product use or prescribing habits, but company collaborations with providers regarding the feasibility of new technological developments fall outside of that intended goal and are extremely sensitive. The greatest risk will lie in forcing early disclosure that may prematurely expose company pipelines and long-term business strategies, all of which will put companies at a competitive disadvantage when conducting business in Minnesota. I think the remainder of my comments were addressed by the amendments Senator Mahdi proposed. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Mr. Cypher, I believe you are last in our list. If you could please come and briefly offer your testimony.
Please.
Once again, I'm Clark Cypher. I represent Pharma. I'm Deputy Vice President of Policy. They've spoken a lot of the details, and between the drug industry and the device industry, our issues are similar. I'm going to really touch on the issue of philosophical divide. This bill and the two that are following it in testimony today are part of a package we've seen out there. There are individuals who would prefer that all marketing go away. You know, the quote was made earlier in testimony about Dr. Sidney Wolf. He's an advocate for an organization called Public Citizen. Well, Dr. Wolf is on record saying, what type of drugs does he like? He said generics. So the generic manufacturers have it easy. They have public policies in place for them, and all the work and research has been done. The only people who would market products are people who come out with new and innovative products. In terms of sales forces, the industry is undergoing tremendous tumult. I mean, the economy is ravaging all of us. I would say we are in no way associated with the way the banking industry has operated. I heard some mention of that, of relationships. No such things exist. Yeah, I believe we've actually laid off about 35,000 folks in the past 7 months alone. So the economy is hurting everybody. I will say when it comes to this bill, we have heard complaints over the years, and there have been documented cases of violations and probably inappropriate behaviors. I believe it was passed out to you and updated the Pharma Code. Everybody refers to the Pharma Code, and it was the first of its kind on a code of interactions. There have to be some ground rules. The companies I represent about 85 to 90% of all salespeople for individual drug firms and about 75 to 80% of all branded drug sales in the United States. So this has very far-reaching, and all the companies are signatories to this, and I believe about 25 other companies. I think it was 25 a week ago. There's a website. You can see all these sorts of things. This does have teeth, and it takes a lot of effort to move organizations to make change, but we have made dramatic strides in moving them towards, and we will continue. We have responded. We have heard concerns. It goes to I'll bring up the issue of the JAMA article that people hold up the Journal of American Medicine. Medical Association as being the end-all, be-all, and it is a fantastic journal. But the issue associated when it comes to marketing is both the authors and all the articles that they reference in those articles are all parts of organizations and boards that are against the pharmaceutical industry. Some people testifying later, there may be individuals on their boards whose authors are there. They have a particular slant, and if I quote a colleague of mine, likely it's going to sound the same thing as what might come out of my mouth. But just because someone says it does not make it fact. So I will leave it at that, and I can answer any questions as is.
Thank you, Mr. Sniper. Any questions from members? Senator Hahn.
Oh, well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess one of the things I just wanted to ask somebody on the panel, we've got, I don't know who sent out the handout here talking about prescription drug costs, and maybe that was somebody in one of the witnesses, but again, I would just ask the question, if this is designed to control costs in prescription drugs, I'm not sure that I'm seeing a lot of evidence from what we've seen that that's a huge problem. I also, if anybody can speak to the relationship between the costs of doing the contact with providers and research costs. Is that something that you can address?
In terms of the drug industry, the pharma numbers in 2008 and 08, $50.2 billion spent on research. Marketing numbers, best we have, is $21 billion. But that includes $16.5 billion of samples that we've had to value. The samples do not have a value. They're given away for free. But for purposes of U.S. tax purposes, there's had to have some value put in place. So between direct-to-consumer advertising, costs of sales forces, events, sponsorships, what have you, you're probably looking at about $6.5 to $7 billion.
Well, and Madam Chair, and thank you, thank you for that comment. I guess that was one of the things I wanted to come out in testimony. I'd heard and had discussions with people prior to this meeting that suggested that the amount of money that the pharmaceutical companies, in particular, spend on advertising and the direct contact with professionals was far in excess of their research costs. And I was looking for information on that, and I appreciate your bringing that out, that it's something like six times the amount in research that is spent than is on the detailing or the sales work. And so I guess I'm just wondering if these data that have been provided about the relatively lack of growth in prescription drug costs and the spending on prescription drugs and health plans is not growing. In fact, says Medicare Part D benefit spending per enrollee declined from 06 to 07. What are we trying to accomplish by doing this? If we're trying to control a significant portion of costs, why are we going after a sector that represents a relatively small portion that isn't growing?
Thank you. Senator Marty, do you
Ma'am,
wish to make
I would respond to Senator Hahn to just say that I don't know who you're talking to and saying it's not growing, but, I mean, in the last decade, pharmaceutical prices have gone through the roof, and I know a whole lot of people, seniors and others than seniors, who are struggling to pay the prices. And well, you may not see it as a problem. I think a lot of our constituents do see it as a problem.
Well, and Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I'm just pointing to something that was distributed to us that was reporting data from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The Office of the Actuary released the federal government's figures on national health care spending. These results point to an ongoing sharp decline in retail prescription drug spending growth. Says the health expenditures have now declined in seven of the last 8 years. I don't know if this is the be-all and end-all, but I haven't seen any data that shows that the drug costs as a system have been skyrocketing that would require the kind of action that your bill is directed at trying to manage, and I'm just not sure that this is the right approach to do that.
Senator Corian and Senator Lynch.
Well, I would just say this is just another bill that I do not support. I don't see where there's a problem here. I guess I can't see it. So I'm in a minority, I'm sure. But I just, you know, I've said this all along. Every time the legislature's in session, nobody is safe. It's just more and more laws. All you got to do is look back at that row of books back there.
more and more and more and more laws. I just think if people would act more with common sense, the world would be a better place. And I just think that this is just more laws that are not needed, in my opinion. So I'm going to be voting no.
Senator Lynch, Senator Berglund, sorry. I think Senator Lynch, go ahead and then Senator.
Madam Chair, I'll yield to Senator Berglund first.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Senator Marty, I do have concern about some of the language in your bill regarding samples. And, you know, I realize you're trying, but under your bill, a sample may not be distributed to an uninsured or low-income person if there's evidence that there is another less costly drug available. And the problem with that is that the less costly drug may not be available in a sample form. And if you're uninsured and low-income, you still may not be able to afford to purchase the lower-cost drug. And then with the amendment, you've said that, you know, the drugs could be given from a sample if they're being distributed for brief therapeutic periods or for brief therapeutic trial. And the problem is that people aren't always uninsured for brief periods. And so if a provider is trying to help a patient who has a chronic disease that is going to need medication on an ongoing basis, they're not even going to want to try to give them a sample for a brief period if they can't, if they know they're not going to be able to continue the medication.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Senator Berglund, the reason SMDC, I'm told, is banned is not accepting samples, the reason Park-Nicolet's trying to stop them, the reason providers are trying to stop them is because they see that they're being used to promote more expensive drugs to people who can't afford them. The sample runs out, and again, I don't remember if it was in this committee or elsewhere, that we've heard from people who, doctors who will say they prescribe a drug to somebody and they find out later that the patient stopped taking the drug because they couldn't afford the refill when there might have been a $3 or $4, not a generic, but an alternative drug, much less expensive drug. When they're marketing Vioxx, the drugs that often have bad side effects, they're often far cheaper drugs. They're not generics. They're competing types of drugs. And the industry is not trying to promote the less expensive drugs. They have obvious self-interest in doing it. I'm not arguing that they shouldn't want to be selling their most expensive drugs, but the point is a whole lot of people who are working in the field, including the doctors, including some of the health plans, are saying the problem with the free samples is they're not doing a net positive for the patients. If the industry really wanted to help the patients, they could obviously just donate money to the health plan, to the doctor, to whoever, and say, use this to pick the most appropriate drug for the patient instead of the most expensive ones that we're going to give you the samples of.
Senator Berger.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Marty, you know, we have an imperfect health care system, and we're not going to fix that all this year, and we're certainly not going to cover all the uninsured this year. And so, you know, I think it is the responsibility of a provider when someone does have the opportunity to become insured to discuss with them the most cost-effective alternatives there are for their drug usage. But when you're uninsured, the whole world isn't at your disposal in terms of the choices that you have. And so sometimes providers want a patient that has a chronic disease to get some medication for it because they know their condition's just going to deteriorate without it. And if the patient can't afford to fill a prescription, they might want to be able to use a sample. And I think the restrictions you have in your bill make it impossible in some situations to be able to provide the drug.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, on that point, are you concerned about the restriction, the evidence-based medicine support? Is that the concern?
No. I'm not in favor of giving out drug samples that are going to harm people, but I'm talking about that you can't give out a drug if you have another drug that is of a lesser cost. I mean, you know, we might be talking about something that's hundreds of dollars, and the lesser cost is still hundreds of dollars. And, you know, the person who's uninsured isn't going to be able to afford to get one of them if they have to purchase it themselves. And the other one under your legislation would not be available to be given out by sample.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I apologize. I had to step out for a little bit. And so if anybody's asked this, just tell me to stop. But in your language about the people who were on the formulary committee not being able to receive gifts or samples, I don't have a problem with the gifts, but if someone is expected to make good decisions about whether a drug is useful or effective, I would assume that, well, makes sense to me anyway, that they should maybe have some experience with patients who have been using those drugs. Are we together so far?
Madam Chair, I'm assuming lots of people on formulary committees have not dispensed all of the drugs that they've never used many of the drugs that they're dealing with on a formulary committee, because a formulary committee is dealing with, I mean, if you're dealing with pediatric drugs and you're a doctor who deals with seniors, you're not going to have ever dealt with any of those pediatric ones. You're still making decisions on the formulary committee.
All right. Okay.
I'm not sure that you personally having prescribed them or personally having used them, taken them, whatever, I don't know that that would be beneficial to serve on a formulary committee.
See, I think it actually, Madam Chair, Senator Marty, would be useful to have that personal knowledge of what drugs are effective, which ones have weird side effects, which ones have been well accepted by patients, and which ones have not. And especially if it's a new drug, I'm thinking that maybe that the samples that would be provided would be a way to gain some of that knowledge.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, the difficulty is their drugs are not given out as an educational tool. The marketing is not educational. Senator Sharon has a bill that would try and provide educational marketing to doctors, where we use pharmacists or nurses to go out and provide evidence-based medicine, what we know works and doesn't work for types of things. The marketers here who are providing the free samples are doing so to sell a specific drug. They're not doing it to provide neutral information. You don't expect them to. You expect them to try and sell their drugs. And that's the reason the formulary committee, what you want is a neutral person, somebody who's going to make the best choices based on all the evidence. And I'm not sure. I mean, it's not the biggest deal in my mind. I just remember there have been some very great concerns about some bias in the formulary committee.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Marty. Very sensitive and supportive of nearly any and all efforts to that seek to address cost containment and healthcare reform, that's for sure. And I am committed to working with Senator Grassley and Senator Klobuchar on their efforts with regard to this situation. I am concerned that we are potentially positioning Minnesota to be at a competitive disadvantage. And my concerns, frankly, are they probably fall more outside of the realm of healthcare reform on this issue and are geared more towards the bioscience industry and economic development in the state of Minnesota. And so I would like to say that I'm interested in working on this, but I think that the more appropriate vehicle, and certainly a vehicle that I'm much more comfortable with, is addressing this at a federal level.
Thank you. Senator Lynch, just for your information, this bill has been requested by Business, Jobs, and Industry, so it will be going there as well to address your concerns. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Marty, just Senator Lynch's question, I'd like to know if you would care to respond to some of the things that the testifiers from Medtronic talked about, their sort of unique or maybe their different approach to marketing as opposed to the pharmaceutical industry. And I think they raised some concerns about the way your bill is written that would be an impediment to their actually being successful, and to the very point that Senator Lynch is making, putting us at a potential disadvantage in our healthcare industry and the desire to grow it, and we all know how important that is. And so if you could maybe comment a little bit about how your bill would affect that and some of their concerns. I know we've talked a lot about the pharmaceutical part, but maybe on the medical device portion of this.
Senator Madam Hardy? Chair, Senator Hand, again, I've been trying to address the concerns. I will commit to continuing to work with the industry. We put in some things related to training, making sure that's exempted from the gifts, training expenses, and compensation, whether it's for royalties related to medical devices, because I'm not arguing that they shouldn't have. It's a good industry. I want them to have good ties with medical doctors, people who are necessary for their work. The important thing is to have a fair connection there and a publicly disclosed connection there, and make sure that they're not over. I mean, there have been articles in a number of papers, from local ones to New York Times and others, talking about some of the situations that were really unethical situations. And I think that's the attempt to do that. This will shut down the industry. This will do that. Again, somebody said this would be only the second state to include medical devices. Well, first of all, there aren't many who have anything on pharmaceuticals even. So we're talking a handful of states, and Massachusetts, the other state, the one that's done it already, has a big industry like ours. I think what we're trying to do, and I will commit to continuing to work with them before Jobs Committee and so on, is to try and address some of those concerns. I think disclosure is good, but it's not sufficient. I think some guidelines, some requirements, I should say, are important. And I don't want to dismiss. It's a big industry in this state, as it is in a number of others. It's very big here, and I don't want to belittle that or downplay that at all, because it's good for the economy, the business, plus it's good for medical devices that we need. I'm not. There's no dispute on any of that.
And Madam Chair, and
Senator Hamm,
Senator Marty, I appreciate that, and I hope that if this does progress, that there will be continued work on that. I do get concerned about the kinds of things that are being advocated here that don't apply to any other industry in the state of Minnesota, and I think that if they did apply, they would have a very detrimental effect on our economy generally. And I think what we're talking about is trying to regulate the marketing practices of a very complex industry that, granted, has a fairly large interaction, significant portion of that business is with state governments and the federal government, which makes it even more complicated. But I get concerned when we're trying to find a way to say, here is the best way to do that. Here's the best way to market that. Here's the best way to bring these products to market. And particularly if these numbers, and I know that you may be disputing those, but I haven't seen anything contrary that would suggest that the portion of healthcare costs that are being affected by medical device costs and prescription drug costs is really not the biggest driver in the overall growth of healthcare costs. And so I just have a general concern about the attempt to try to manage through legislative process the marketing practices of a fairly large, complicated, significant industry in the state. So I just encourage you to keep working with them if this goes forward.
Thank you. Members, I think we're ready. Senator Marty?
I feel very strongly that the sample language is very important the way it is, because it is a problem. It is being used to hook people on drugs that are more expensive than the ones they appropriate. But I've heard concerns from several members of the committee, and I respect that, and I don't know if Senator Bergen was planning to strike the new language on 2.9 through 2.11. would love to talk more with members about that, but I'm willing to, if you wish to strike that language, I'm willing to go ahead with that and work on it next year on that.
Senator Marty, would you like to wait and
Madam Chair, I was just curious if Senator Berglund
has an amendment.
How strongly she felt, or Senator Lynch, because they both expressed concerns about that. And I realize it's touchy because, again, we have a letter from some of the community clinics that are using the drug. I mean, when you have the patient in front of you who needs the drug, if you have anything to give them, it's good. The difficulty is it's hooking them sometimes on a much more expensive drug. But I understand the difficulty of that issue. And Senator Berglund, I don't know what you're thinking about that.
Senator Berglund, I don't know if you're ready, or we could move the bill and then wait until you can work on this before it goes to the, because it does go to business, jobs, and industry. So we could work in the meantime.
Chair,
if you want.
I think Senate Counsel has a suggestion.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Please.
Madam Chair and members, on page 2, line 11, if we delete the clear superiority of the drug over less costly alternatives available and insert the use of the drug. So it would be if there is evidence-based medicine to support the use of the drug.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund and Ms. Kavanaugh, I wonder if instead of, I mean, there shouldn't be a drug on the market if there's no use for it. And since they're not giving the sample for anything, if you're going to do that, I would just suggest you strike the new language on line after the if there is evidence-based medicine to support. I'd strike that whole clause, I think, would make more sense.
It's fine.
Yeah. Senator Berglund, is that?
Yeah, that's fine.
That's good. Follow up. Senator Marty, could you please repeat that amendment?
Madam Chair, I would just strike the new language after patients on line 10 and all the language on line 11 up to the or for distribution language that we added as an amendment earlier.
Any questions from members? Okay, all of those in favor of that amendment signifying by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I will move the bill, be recommended pass, referred to the Committee on Jobs with a commitment to continuing to work medical device industry. Again, I've been trying to address the concerns. I know they have more concerns, and I will continue talking before we get to Jobs Committee.
Thank you. Any further discussion on Senate File 1237? If not, all of those in favor of moving Senate File 1237 and referring that to business, jobs, and industry, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, say no.
No.
Now I am in doubt, so I'm going to ask you to raise your hands. Those in favor of referring the Senate File 1237 to business, jobs, and industry, please raise your hand. Those opposed? I think the bill passes and is going to be referred to business, jobs, and industry.
Thank you, Madam Chair,
Thank
members
you.
Of the committee, and I will commit to continuing working with you.
Next, we have Senator Sharon. Welcome to the committee, Senator Sharon. You have been patiently coming in, coming in and out of the room, waiting for your turn. I hope the people that you invited to testify are here. Dr. Jacobs, welcome back. Here. Thank you.
Want me to begin? Shall I begin?
Go ahead, Senator
should
Sharon.
I
welcome.
To you, or should I
yes, I'll pass it to him in just
okay,
a minute.
Thank
so
you. Thank
please
you.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm very happy to come to in front of the committee today. I have a bill, Senate File 895, to present to you. I know you've had a long day, and I appreciate that it's hard to stay, from my experience, to stay focused. But I hope that you will pull up a little extra energy and listen to what it is that I am seeking your support for from this bill today. I also will have, after at any point that you would advise, an amendment, the A1 amendment for the bill. It is an author's amendment. I'm hoping someone will.
I think, members, you have the amendment in your packet. Any questions about the amendment? If not, all of those in favor of the A1 amendment? I need somebody to move it from our committee. Senator Marty moves the A1 amendment. All of those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you very
Senator
much.
Senator Sharon.
This bill, with your support, will establish something called an academic detailing program, or in simpler terms, a program that will provide prescribers of medications with objective information on prescription drugs. And that information will be based on the best available evidence-based science. You might wonder if this is available now. Well, it is available in lots of different forms in lots of different places on the internet and various places that would require the prescriber to sort through a lot of information in order and do a lot of their own analysis to determine what is valid and what is not valid. And that would take the time of the prescriber away from the essential function of providing patient care and making the medical interventions that they need to assist their clients. It separates what the academic detailing program will do is separate out in an unbiased way the important messages about medications from the noise that's in the internet and from other sources. An increasing number of states are exploring academic detailing as a mechanism for improving the quality of care, safety of care, increasing the value derived from drug therapies. Pennsylvania, Vermont, South Carolina have already passed programs and they are in operation. 2007, Maine passed legislation, and in 2008, New Hampshire, the District of Columbia, New York, and Massachusetts passed laws creating academic detailing programs. There are six other states considering this or expanding their existing programs. One way the health care outcomes are improved by academic detailing is by reducing overprescribing. Overprescribing, if we can reduce that, has a secondary gain as well. That secondary gain is reduced cost that comes from prescribing patterns. And although improved quality health care outcomes and safety and an increased value derived from the therapy that comes with medications, those primary goals of academic detailing do not mean that there isn't also a secondary gain of demonstrated cost savings by those who participate in academic detailing programs. And because there's other states that have been engaged in this program, we're able to do the to demonstrate findings that, in fact, those cost savings do occur. So in other words, in addition to better healthcare outcomes, academic detailing provides physicians and prescribers with unbiased information, separating the information from the noise. It encourages the use of the safest medication. It's the most effective medication. And other things being equal, the least costly drug. And what's really important is it allows the prescriber to focus on their care of the patient. Evidence-based academic detailing programs rely on scientific perspectives rather than marketing hype. This program, with your support, will provide an important tool to provide some balance to the sales-focused information they receive through the industry and through its sales representatives. It provides some balance by providing a source of information that is unbiased. The pharmaceutical industry, as you've probably heard through the day, spends a lot of money promoting and marketing prescription drugs. And so I think for today, because I suspect you've heard about that, I'm going to pass that information. But only suffice to say that part of that money is spent specifically on marketing their medications specifically and directly to physicians. Over 25 years of academic detailing, it has shown repeatedly to be effective in promoting safe and appropriate drug use. A recent summary of evidence about improving physician clinical care and patient health through the use of unbiased educational programs concluded that the interactive techniques that are required in these programs, those interactive techniques of detailing, are the most effective means to improve physician practices and patient outcomes. Specifically, the academic detailing program operates independent from drug companies, critical, are located in a medical school or a school of pharmacy. They provide unbiased, balanced, evidence-based information to prescribers regarding the safety and efficacy of drugs. They employ physicians, pharmacists, nurses, and other clinical professionals to give the prescriber guidance on potential benefits and possible harms of drugs. They use one-on-one interaction tailored to the needs of the prescriber in their setting and the client caseload that they carry. They help promote appropriate prescribing habits that enhance quality care, health of patients, and cost effectiveness. They rely on voluntary participation. They provide continuing medical education credits for meeting academic detailers. I can go through and will later go through the specifics of the bill, but I would like for you to have an opportunity to hear from our testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Dr. Jacobs, you're going first.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Don Jacobs, Chairman and CEO of Hennepin Faculty Associates. As I mentioned earlier, this is part two, and I hope to continue to make the connection between what I have to say here and my previous testimony. It was, I hope, apparent from my earlier testimony that the financial stakes are high for payers, patients, employers, and industry when it comes to the health care costs driven by providers' choices. I think the amount of interest in today's hearing certainly points that out. This is particularly true for prescription medications. The need for timely, reliable, evidence-based, and unbiased information about pharmaceuticals is evident. This educational process should be completely uncoupled from a marketing or sales agenda. Such unbiased and objective information is currently not easily available in the busy day-to-day practice of medicine. The alternative and prevailing practice has been for salespeople from the pharmaceutical industry, often referred to as detail men or women, to provide a physician with promotional information rather than a balanced evidence base to promote their company's drugs, even if they are less effective or more costly than other available options. They do this because it works. In recent years, the pharmaceutical industry has spent nearly $30 billion annually on promotion and marketing, with over $7 billion on physicians alone on an annual basis. They have increasingly targeted nurse practitioners and physician assistants, and now over 20% of their expenditures are focused there as access to physicians has become more difficult. One does not need to watch television for very long or read magazines and newspapers to see their enormous expenditures on direct-to-consumer advertising. Our citizens in this country spend more per capita on pharmaceuticals than any other country in the world. The companies spend those billions of dollars because it works, and they make a very healthy return on that investment. In the early years of this decade, the cumulative profits of the top 10 pharmaceutical companies in the Fortune 500 exceeded the cumulative profits of the other 490 companies combined. Now that is effective marketing. What can we do about it? One thing we can do is to provide reliable alternatives for the ongoing education of our vast healthcare workforce. This requires a dynamic process. Things are changing all the time. We're making progress. Other states and other countries have effectively removed the marketing influence from those decisions through the development of so-called academic detailing programs, a well-thought-out and implemented program to provide a value-based approach to these important decisions can significantly reduce pharmaceutical costs and overall healthcare costs. I believe this legislation will provide such an alternative in Minnesota and deserves your support. On a national level, I know Senator Hahn has questioned why we should care this much about this small sector. But this small sector of pharmaceuticals and devices is about a $300 billion expenditure across our country each year. It's no small change, even if it happens to be a smaller percentage sector. So there is definitely money to be had by doing a better job of prescribing. I think providing the right information to providers in the right way is important to do so. I know that this body, this state, values education. K-12 seems almost a sacred cow. Higher education will be supported by this state. I think the education of our healthcare workforce deserves some support from this body, and I do believe right now that the education of our healthcare workforce on pharmaceuticals is inappropriately biased.
Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Jacobs, I'm sorry. I did not mean by my previous comments to suggest that $300 billion is a small amount. That's certainly not my opinion. My point was simply to try to say that given the data that we've been provided here, that the growth in the costs of pharmaceutical drugs has been very modest compared to other parts of the healthcare industry, and as a percentage of the whole are relatively small. And so my point was just the disproportionate, perhaps, focus on a portion of the healthcare costs that it seems to me to be a little bit out of balance, considering the nature of the proposals we've heard so far and the intrusiveness that they represent into a essentially private industry. But I did want to ask one question. You made a comment about the profit that the pharmaceutical industry has achieved. And I don't know if you quoted exact numbers, but you said it was quite a lot. Am I to take from that that you are against companies making profit?
No, not at all. But I think that there is a level of responsibility within our economy that we're trying to achieve. I think somebody said earlier at the healthcare reform oversight meeting that we had that healthcare doesn't really work very well as a consumer-driven market. I know for decades we've tried to create that, but there are some significant flaws. I think one of the reasons this is important to target, because this is something we can relatively easily do something about and lower our costs. There are a lot of other issues in healthcare that deserve our attention that are going to be much more difficult to achieve those kind of cost savings. Healthcare costs in pharmaceuticals and devices is going up faster than the costs and reimbursement in hospitals and in providers, and those two sectors make up about 65% of healthcare costs.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Dr. Jacobs, and I think all of us are interested in trying to find ways to keep healthcare costs manageable. There are just some of us who are very mistrustful of having government be the organizing, agent to make that happen, given the lack of ability that government has shown in other things it has tried to do to be very efficient. You mentioned, do you know what the profit margin is of the pharmaceutical industry? You mentioned that they make a lot of money, but what is the margin? What is their percentage of profit what is their margin?
I can't tell you that right now. I just don't know.
The reason I'm asking that is that if you have a very, very large volume of sales and you may make a very large volume of profit, but it might be a very small percentage. And I think that's important to note, that if you're talking about working on a very small margin, and I don't know, in fact, maybe there's somebody here from the pharmaceutical industry that can attest to that, I don't think, and I'm willing to be corrected, that the profit margins of the pharmaceutical industry are extraordinary. In fact, I'm quite confident that you could find many, many other industry sectors that have higher margins than the pharmaceutical industry. So my point is that if we don't say that it's wrong to make profit, and if the margins are modest, which I am willing to hear testimony to that effect, then I don't know why we should be so focused on trying to go after them to prevent them from doing that. And I think you're trying to make, a moral argument that there's something bad going on here, but I'm not getting the point. And so I guess I'd like to have somebody, if there is anyone, who can testify about what the margins are in the pharmaceutical industry that might shed some light on this, if you're not.
Senator Martin. Is it Senator Martin?
Senator Sharon.
You know, I think that that's probably a reasonable request to get that information for you, Senator. I do not have that with me, because the focus of the bill here is not is about providing for providers a source of information about the efficacy of drugs that is not that comes from an unbiased source, that it provides a place for clinicians to go to get one-to-one kind of contact about the information that they need on their prescribing practices, and allows them to rely on an academic detailing process for safe and affordable quality health care. And to speak to that, I think that it might be helpful for us to continue with our testifiers, and we'll try to bring the information to you, Senator, that's related more to whether or not you want to constrain the pharmaceuticals' profits. That's not really what this bill is about. This bill is about offering something to clinicians to improve safety and quality of care.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hand, we're going to have to, we're going to try and get one more witness in here, but this one is, it may have the impact of saving money, as several other states found, but the purpose of this is to make sure they have good academic, sound research information on most appropriate drug use.
And Senator, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, and I guess I have some concerns about that, too, given that I don't think anybody is unbiased. I think one of the virtues of having pharmaceutical companies do what they do is that people know what their bias is. I think academic information may be helpful, but I'm not sure I would say it is unbiased. There may be biases in what their intention is. If the intent, for example, is to find lowest cost things, they may have a bias to do things that may not be totally revealing of other I don't know. I'm just, my point is everybody has a bias. Every institution has some bias. I'm just not sure that substituting the bias of the academic world, bias of competing companies, is going to achieve the result that you hope, but we'll hear more testimony.
Thank you.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, that's a plea for the bill that we laid on the table. If we had some transparency in pricing, we might be able to tell what profit margins are, but you're never going to find out from the drug companies what their profit margins are.
Mr. Chairman, and to Senator Prettner-Solin, I'm not sure that that's true. I think you can find good information about profit margins of economic sectors. That's pretty commonly known. I think investors want to know those things when they invest in corporations, so these are publicly traded companies for the most part, I think, so that information is available. And maybe we'll have somebody from the industry that can talk a little bit about that.
Senator Sharon, do you have one of your witnesses more able to come back this evening? Because we'll be continuing this bill when we...
Thank you, Senator Marty. I would like to introduce Dr. Marilyn Speedy. She is the Dean of the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm speaking in favor of Senate File 895. I believe Senator Sharon has done an excellent job of describing the process of academic detailing, so I won't spend my time on that. I would like to speak to the benefits of academic detailing beyond prescription drug costs. When drugs are used appropriately, we know that overall health costs go down. When patients are receiving the most cost-effective drugs, backed by the most current medical evidence, they will save doctor's visits, they'll save hospitalizations, and their health care will improve, and that's well documented. And so by providing this information and improving prescribing habits of physicians, you do often save prescription drug costs, because you are causing physicians to prescribe generics or substitutes that are most cost effective. But actually a lot of the impact is on healthcare outcomes, because you're providing a balanced view of how a given disease state is managed. So the costs also go beyond savings to the state for its Medicare, Medicaid patients, although that's often the way that the specific drugs or diseases that are addressed are targeted. By having the physicians learn about drugs, they do also then use that same knowledge for their other patients who are supported by employer-based drug benefits and so on. So I think there are many both direct and indirect benefits to this. The state that has probably the best documented system is Pennsylvania. It's called PACE, Pharmaceutical Assistance Contract for the Elderly. When it was launched in 2005, they monitored the first year very carefully. They had 10 drug consultants who made 1,000 visits in the first year. 200 of those resulted in discussions beyond the specific drug class that was being addressed. The service was highly rated by physicians, and the cost was about equal to the drug savings, but there probably were additional savings. They didn't document those. The College of Pharmacy is able and willing to assist the Department of Health in implementation of such a program. We certainly have the ability to prepare materials. We could pilot a academic detailing program, as have other schools, for instance, in South Carolina right now, and we can evaluate the impact. So we stand very much in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Speedy. If I don't see any questions, what we're going to have to do is lay the bill over till this evening. I think we're meeting at 5:30 in here. We'll start with this bill, then we'll go on with the rest of the agenda. So, with that, we'll pick up your bill first thing this evening, Senator Sharon. With that, this meeting is in recess.